It's moving.
Oh, yes, good, okay.
Very important adjectives. Many things that you must celebrate in life. Instead of mourning all the time, the Pretoria. Am I right, the Pretoria? Spot on. Can we pull the door or push the door? Can those who are outside come through?
Line for us.
So if we can't close, we would release and blessing the team. They are a team of unfortunately young men, unfortunately, working quite together with Al, who also is another man. I'm not too sure what Mama Sonny thought, what she left behind, you know, team of men. But a good legacy on the part. Maybe it was one of empowering these young men. But I'm sure in the course of time there shall be some other women participating in those programs. Without waste of time, we also have a number of other competing programs of parliament. And that unfortunately, that has actually led us to not to have a number of other members of committee present with us here. But those that have made it, we must appreciate the time, Mr. Oromita, Mom B, Victoria, Mr. Duli, and Mama Bota, and a number of others who are here. We appreciate. This is, should be one way of trying to get us going, especially in the areas where we are. Well, what we also are supposed or expected to do going forward in our own community is to get our programs also having the areas on climate change. As our saying, these are cross-cutting areas. Which then means that with the white paper that's there on climate change within the Environment Department, we must familiarize ourselves with that and also be able to see how best that factors into our own program in our respective quality. Okay, for those of you that I take it that we are all settled and also declare in court our training program open. And then follow a program that we have in Camp South. We have, if there are any things to say, I think that we just go straight to the program itself. We have a 20-minute session that we'll be listening to Ms. Nodier and Mr. Fakir. From WWF, and then we engage on that input thereafter. Thank you. Are they here? Oh, you have Mr. Fakir as well?
I'm sorry, I think it's a bit of a confusion on the program. Because there's today and tomorrow, I've taken today and he will be here tomorrow, so apologies if things.
Fine. Okay.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you, the House, for the privilege of being here. It always is a wonderful honour to come and present to you and to be able to engage with you. Now, because time is quite shortened, I would ask you that you don't try and follow the presentation from the handout, because I'm going to skip a lot of things. Okay, so first, just to outline what I'm going to cover, and I hope that it is serving the needs of the members. And please interrupt me with questions, or obviously that's the chairperson's prerogative, but I don't mind being interrupted. So first, we're going to look at the physical aspects of climate change, the causes, and the physical impacts of those causes. Then we're going to look at the social and economic results of those physical impacts and the costs to the economy and to human beings. And then turn to solutions. We speak about a just transition to a climate resilient and low carbon economy, and I would like to unpack those things a bit. And part of that would be looking at the concept of a carbon budget while we need it. And then I have got sections on the role of Parliament in these processes at a national and international level. But I think some of that we'll be skipping because, I mean, you understand your role far better than I do. Sorry, page down isn't working, enter isn't working. Alright, so turning to the physical planetary processes, we have human activity emitting what we call greenhouse gases, and we call them greenhouse gases because they become like a blanket around the Earth, holding in heat. So as more gases get into the atmosphere, it heats the planet up more and more. So, emitting the greenhouse gases from human activity leads to this global warming effect. And it's on average, we talk about the temperature on average around the world going up by a certain amount, because the temperatures at various regions will vary. So, although the average temperature might go up by 2 degrees, 1.5 degrees, in some parts of the world, it will go up much more, and in some, perhaps less. In South Africa, we're probably going to be hotter. So these greenhouse gases are released when we burn oil or coal, when we make cement, from various land use practices, like every time you cut down a tree and burn it, or when you plow, carbon dioxide is released from the earth. The gases that cows or human beings or any animal passes is a cause of methane. And we speak about those as being carbon dioxide equivalent because they're trying to measure the impact of these various kinds of gases on the temperature. So they just have a way of making them all equivalent, so they're calling carbon dioxide equivalent. Carbon dioxide and methane are the two biggest. So the temperature goes up on average around the world, and these greenhouse gases, the release of them has accelerated since industrialization. Before that, human activities didn't really release a lot of greenhouse gases, and the Earth was able to reabsorb. So there is partly a natural cycle of release of these greenhouse gases and reabsorption, but we are now accelerating that to an extent beyond what the planet can cope with. And since, against pre-industrial levels, before the 1900s, the temperature's already gone up by nearly 1 degree. And scientists project into the future what the impact can be of a certain amount of release of greenhouse gases. So there's a relationship. So much gases would lead to this amount of temperature increase. And then they predict what that temperature increase might do to the weather and climate pattern. So they're saying that if we look at an average global increase of 1.5 degrees or 2 degrees, these ranges of predictions, we start hitting what are called tipping points. Where it now becomes beyond our capacity to really pull back from this extreme climate change, and beyond which we can't really predict what the complex system called the Earth is going to do. We're going to, a tipping point, for example, is if all the ice melts. We can't refreeze that ice. So if we look at this 1.52 degrees point, if we've already done 0.7, you can see that we have a real challenge to not exceed those degrees of heat. Okay, that's just the picture showing the greenhouse gases floating in the atmosphere and how they act to reflect the heat back down. More heat than previous. These are the predicted temperature rises. In brackets is 2050 for South Africa, and there's also the temperature for 2100. And as you can see, those temperatures in South Africa are far higher than the global average that's being predicted. And these, if you increase the temperature, all sorts of things start happening. So, with melting ice, the sea level rises, and you start getting coastal events like erosion of the coast, flooding of the coast. About half the world's people live around the coast, and they're going to be threatened by rising sea levels and sea events. You get, and the important thing about climate change is not just the sort of even change, it's extreme. It's climate variability more than even change. So you get extreme events, floods, droughts, storms, various disasters. So turning now to the more social and economic impacts, one of the major impacts is the issue of water security. And this is particularly an issue for us in South Africa, where we are already a water-scarce country. So that tells you what the predictions are about the water availability situation. The red is where it will become water-scarce, and the yellow is where there will be water stress. And you can see the impact on people. Now, one of the things about Africa is that, not in South Africa so much, but the rest of Africa, most of the agriculture depends on rain. We have a lot of irrigation in South Africa, but in the rest of Africa, most people rely on the rain to come. And now, there'll be less rain in some areas, or rains will come at a different time, and crops are not adapted to those shifting rain patterns, and we will increase hunger. That's the story in about the stress and scarcity. It tells you how much amount of water that is per person per year. Go and look at your own water bill and see how much you're using in a month and multiply it up by 12, and you will have a sense of whether that's adequate water. South Africa, so the blue is in 1990, where we were already a water stress situation. You can see we will progress by 2025 to be a water scarce country. And we are the worst in all compared to all those countries in terms of our water supply. This also impacts on food security, the major issue. That is how agricultural productivity is projected to shift around the world due to temperature and rain changes. So the red part is where production becomes less, up to 50% less, and the green part is where it becomes more. So what's very interesting to me about this graph is that, or map, is that the heaviest emitters of the greenhouse gases have been those countries which have been industrialized for longer. So it's Europe, the United States, and the global temperature goes up, but it means areas which have been historically very cold will now be warmer, they'll be more temperate, they can actually benefit from the climate change that they have caused, or have been the greatest cause of, and we who haven't benefited from that industrialization and that development to that extent pay the heaviest price. So looking at some of the other social and economic impacts. So if one thinks about all those physical things that are happening in war, shifting seasons, droughts, floods, species are dying, seas rise, you have evaporation. If the temperature's hotter, when you irrigate, it evaporates faster. All those things impact on things like our fishing, our crops fail, livestock dies, diseases shift. So for example, in South Africa, we don't have a big malaria problem, but now the temperatures change and mosquitoes move south. So we might get malaria problems arising, and putting that on top of our other health challenges, like people's lack of good nutrition, HIV/AIDS, TB, it's just going to put our people and our health system under greater stress. What the graph shows is as the temperature along the bottom, the hotter the temperature is getting, the more people are impacted. Up on the left-hand side is how many millions would be at risk. So on the left is from hunger, malaria, and flooding. So at a 2 degrees, where the colors start kicking in, you can see that the risk of water shortage suddenly shoots right up. The risk of malaria just slowly increases over the whole time and gets to be about 250 to 300 million people by then. And on the right-hand side is the water stress, because that is so much more that you couldn't even use the same scale on the left and right. Okay, this is some of what's going to happen in Southern Africa and then in East Africa, and I won't talk through this in detail because you will have it in your handout. But just to say that those things that are physical results of the changing climate then start affecting your agriculture, your fisheries, where a lot of us depend on livelihoods, on fisheries. It also affects tourism, because if species are increasingly under threat, both plant and animal, those things which draw visitors to us, our country, will no longer be there as an asset to us, and people might not come. I've spoken about things like the health burden. Rising costs. So, there are going to be increased costs in two ways. The one is that we're going to have to do our part to try and help prevent climate change by cutting our emissions, and there's going to be some costs involved in that, although also a lot of cost savings. And then there's going to be the cost of adapting to all of these events. So disaster management kind of costs, but also costs where you try and put in place things before it all happens so that you defend people. It's all going to be very expensive. And the issue about the costs is that the longer you wait to do these things, the more expensive it's going to get. Because if we can do things now, if we can try and keep the temperature down by cutting our emissions, or if we can think ahead and start things like, people putting up shelters in flood areas, if we start providing decent housing and also, you know, really speak to people about why those are not good areas to build, then we prevent some of those impacts hitting them later. So those are the kinds of things where we need to spend the money now to avoid real expenses later. Also, just when we put up low-cost housing, put in ceilings, then people are defended against extremes of temperature. Economic damage, the worldwide system of trade, because everybody's now under pressure to cut their emissions, they are starting to put up trade barriers. We've already seen that with the European Union. Putting up trade barriers against importing goods that have had a lot of emissions used to create them. So we have a huge export industry, and this is going to be heavily impacted unless we change the fact that our electricity and our petrol is very much coming from coal, which is a heavy emitter. Okay, so that's East Africa. Here are some of the costs that I was talking about. So As the temperature goes up in Africa, if we reach those temperatures by those years, then that our percentage of total African GDP that's going to cost us to respond and, sorry, no, this is going to cost us to mitigate. Mitigate is trying to help prevent. So, and that point I was making, the more you delay, the more that's going to cost. Because you're coping with things, and you have to do more and more extreme mitigation. And that's the sort of economic cost. But in terms of human beings, the people really paying the hardest price is the poor, the vulnerable. And as a developing country, obviously, we, you know, our citizens are more vulnerable than, say, people in the developed nations. You know, the rich, if it gets hotter, they switch on the air conditioner. And adding to the problem by doing so, using more energy. But, you know, rural areas in South Africa, people are living on the breadline already. They don't have resilience for any extra stresses. So it's a big developmental challenge. Gender is an issue. I won't work through this whole slide, but women's role and position in society makes them one of the more vulnerable categories. Women don't always own land. They're not always the ones who get jobs first. All of those things make them more vulnerable. They're the ones doing most of the childcare and caring for the elderly and the sick. They can't move around so easily. Okay, solutions. So these phrases, climate resilient, is the adaptation end of the spectrum. It means some impacts are going to already happen. I think most people, you know, we all are experiencing these wild weather events around the world and changes in weather patterns. So some things are already going to happen. We've already put that much emissions into the atmosphere. And adapting to that is what is called building climate resilience. So the best thing you can do for adaptation is to do all the developmental things we're already trying to do in South Africa. Fighting poverty, fighting gender oppression, creating more jobs, our health system. All of that makes people more able to have choices and flexibility and resources in order to respond. Also, the energy security is another big issue, because 25% of South African households do not have access to electricity on the grid. And as a developing country, everybody has a right to those energy services, and yet we are asked to cut our emissions. So we've got to find solutions which don't add to the problem of climate change, but also extend energy to everyone, decent energy, not having to go out and collect wood or use paraffin, which is dangerous, people get, houses get burnt down and so on. So that's the first point I wanted to make, that development and solving our development challenges is one of the biggest answers to climate change. Then ecosystems. I come from WWF, so people often think we care more about the bunnies than the people. But I want to explain why ecosystems are important. Ecosystems is what supplies our water, for example, wetlands, rivers. We're very dependent on our water, and we have little of it in South Africa. So we've really got to defend and repair those aspects of the natural world which supply water to us. For example, when you have a lot of aliens growing, they suck up more water than indigenous plants would, so there's less release for human and animal use. So those are the kinds of things we can do, remove aliens and repair the river. There's a lot to be said around that, but I'll leave it at that. Then we seriously have to do mitigation. Africa has hardly contributed emissions to this whole world problem of climate change. And yet, we're going to be one of the worst affected. But within Africa, South Africa is 50% of African emissions. because of our very coal-intensive economy. So we've had this rich resource of coal, and we've exploited it as we needed to do for our country's development. And now we sit in a position where Secunda for Sasol's coal to oil process is the single worst emitter in the world, at point source. In other words, not us as a country, but as one point, one plant in the world is the worst. So I previously heard people saying, you know, are we not offering to do too much on the global arena? We are almost leading in saying we're going to cut our emissions. I think we're in such a bad situation worldwide, it is so urgent that the whole world cuts, that we have to do our part. We have to do the best we can. There are solutions. We must start spending the country's money, the citizens' money, on things which are climate-friendly and not lock ourselves into infrastructure decisions now, which we'll have to overturn anyway in 5 years or 10 years' time. So everything we do, we have to think emissions, emissions, emissions. However, we cannot, you know, we can do the best that we can in South Africa. We're only 1% of the whole world's emissions. So even if we do our best, if the other countries don't come to the table, specifically developed countries, because they really the worst problem, they're the heaviest emitters, if they don't come to the table, our best will not solve the problem. So that's a huge political challenge. And with COP17 coming in the country, I mean, that, as the host, that challenge rests on our shoulders. And I think that as members of parliament, you have certain constitutional functions of oversight, of strategic direction, of lawmaking. But beyond that, you are our elected representatives as citizens. You're the ones who really carry the mandate from people. And you have a hugely influential role and a big outreach role beyond, you know, those constitutional functions. So I think you really can play very important roles and influencing what happens in the negotiations and also nationally around mitigation. Okay, the rest of the points you can see. I'll just speak to this issue. It's a term that comes up in the negotiations. Common but differentiated responsibility. It means that climate change is a world problem. It doesn't matter where in the world you release the emissions. If they release them in Russia, it nevertheless affects all of us because the atmosphere is one system. So in that sense, it's a common world responsibility, but it's differentiated because we talk about those who have historically emitted the most must take the strongest action now and must pay the heaviest price in money. Whereas those who still are developing countries should be allowed some space around their emissions to still uplift all the people, and then can start also participating in these heavy cuts. So a lot of the political struggles around COP is around those issues. But Ms. Sanjika will tell you much more about that. Often when people talk about, you know, we've got to balance the environment and development, it really isn't about balance. It's about finding a new kind of development that is environmentally sound. And there really are such win-win solutions. It really isn't an either-or. We don't have to balance these things. We have to incorporate both of them in a developmental way. That we don't have to pay a developmental price for being environmentally friendly and vice versa. And it isn't a choice between let's not do anything and then the world will continue as it is. It's a choice between if we don't do anything, we'll be faced with chaotic impacts, impacts that we're unprepared for. The situation will just keep worsening if we just keep emitting. So that's the one choice. versus the choice where we say, okay, we're going to act now, save tomorrow today, so that at least the changes that, so we're going to prevent the worst changes, and at least those that are going to happen, we can be prepared for, and we've built climate resilience into our natural and human society, natural systems and human society. So we're not talking about sort of going back to the dark ages or, yeah. Okay, carbon budget. So if you emit a certain amount of these greenhouse gases, it causes a certain amount of temperature rise worldwide. So that's the relationship between emissions and temperature. Therefore, if you say, I want to stay well below 2 degrees, because already at 2 degrees we're looking at these tipping points, that means you only can emit a certain amount of greenhouse gases. So this graph is about how much can we afford to emit to avoid those kinds of impacts. The green line is developing countries. So you can see the difference between developed countries in the blue and the developing in the green. They must cut immediately and sharply. They're the worst problem and they've already benefited. They don't need a lot of carbon space to keep developing. They're already there. Whereas the developing countries are allowed to increase for a while and then start cutting. Okay, that's about our emissions in Africa. And that's South Africa's emissions compared to the basic countries, Brazil, South Africa, India, China. Also compared to the OECD, which is more the developed nations. And you can see emissions per person on the left. We're not great. So, within South Africa, our government undertook at Copenhagen, or after Copenhagen, to cut our own emissions by 34% by 2020 and 42% by 2025 from our existing path. There's a big debate around this. What does that mean? The government commissioned a study called the Long-Term Mitigation Scenario, which looked at our emissions at the moment and at options for reducing them going into the future. And that had various scenarios, one of which was called growth without constraints, which means we just go full out, emit however much we want, don't try and do anything about it. And then there's a kind of imaginary line which is business as usual. So if we continue doing what we're just doing now, we don't excessively grow without constraints, but we're on the same path we now are. So these reductions are relative to that line. So if you say, this is how much we would have emitted, and now we're going to, in 2020, cut 34% down from that. But the problem is this top line, this business as usual trajectory. It was fixed at a certain point in the long-term mitigation scenario, but now there's attempt to move it up, because then when you cut 34% down from it, you're actually cutting less. So that's quite a debate and, you know, an issue that Parliament might want to investigate more and develop positions on. Where should that top line be? Anyway, so now you can see that the proposal for South Africa is that between 2010 and 2025, our emissions will increase. Just even some of the things we're already planning to do will increase them. The new coal-fired power stations, infrastructure that we can't turn around in a, you know, in a very short time, etc. So also developmental plans. So we go up till 2025, then we plateau. We stop getting growing our emissions, and eventually by 2035 we start cutting them. That means if we look at those commitments and where we are at the moment, that we have a certain what we call a carbon budget that we allow to emit. So, I mean, the honorable members are very used to exercising oversight over our national budget. Please exercise oversight over our carbon budget as well. So this is just looking at the period where we're still increasing, just homing in on that. On the left is how we're spending our carbon budget at the moment. So where are emissions coming from at the moment? The biggest chunk down there is energy industries. Most of our emissions come from coal-fired power stations, petrol, etc. And then the rest. So if we're now going to change our emissions path, what are we going to do in those different sectors and how are we going to allocate our carbon budget? So should we spend more on transport and less on energy? And within transport, should we spend the emissions that we're allowed to have on housing improvements, I mean highway improvement initiatives for more cars to emit more, or should we spend it on public transport? So those are the kinds of, if you only have a limited budget of emissions, the trade-off, you're going to have to decide where best to spend those emissions. And those kind of trade-offs are developmental decisions. Okay, international. Does that mean I'm out of time? Okay. Let me just, sorry, because I don't know all the words. It's the bell thing. I'll quickly go to just this point. You can read it in your handout, but I think that we're going to see massive migration of people around the world, and we have to prepare our societies for that and our hearts. And I would appeal for human solidarity rather than competition. Okay, so the coming issues for COP17, there's two tracks of negotiations. The one is the Kyoto Protocol. I think 37 countries actually made commitments under the Kyoto Protocol. And the protocol exists forever. The contract doesn't go away, it's a kind of contract. But people only made commitments up to 2012. So that was the first commitment period. None of those commitments have been met. And everybody, and has to make commitments for the second period, a 5-year period every time, and we are really at risk that people are not going to commit, countries are not going to make commitments. So one of the big things for COP17 is this issue of the second commitment period for the Kyoto Protocol. We really can't risk that the Kyoto Protocol dies, because Honourable Member Delanga always makes this point, that it's the only legal contract that we have at the moment. If it dies, everybody walks away, and you know, those countries which don't want to take targets are left free. Okay, the other negotiation track is this long-term cooperative action, because Kyoto didn't include developing countries, didn't have to take targets. So we're now talking about a second negotiation track where all countries make some kind of commitment. Both of those need to be legally binding, because it doesn't matter, it doesn't help if countries just make promises, but there's no sanction, there's no consequence if they don't meet those promises. So there has to be, whether it's economic boycotts, trade barriers, or whether there's huge fines, there has to be some kind of sanction. The commitments that countries have put on the table so far leave what we call the big gigaton gap. The amount of emissions that we have to reduce to stay under well below 2 degrees, we are very far from having committed that amount. So that's what we call the gigaton gap. What we've committed compared to what we need to have committed, we as a world. So we in WWF are calling for commitments that meet those targets. And then, because of this common but differentiated responsibility issue, the developed countries must put up money for adaptation, technological development, mitigation in the developing countries. And there's a lot of issues around where should that money come from. So that's what Minister Manuel is involved in, this finance committee. Those are the kinds of issues that they're looking at for the Green Fund. And I could talk, but I want to stick the chair more to some innovative sources of financing that we propose. Well, not just us, lots of people. So this is, you know, we really have a historical responsibility with COP17 coming to our country. And to understand that because we're the hosts, we have to be the facilitators of it. So we really have to do everything in our power that it doesn't die at COP17, that there is some commitment. We have to go into it with high ambition, but we also have to go into it able to facilitate and compromise and come to the table. And those are the challenges that, you know, leadership in this country are faced with. And the time to influence countries' position is before they get to COP17, because otherwise they come in there with a mandate. So an important role for members of parliament would be to participate in that kind of diplomatic work before the time and using your influences. Have meetings with other MPs from around the world. And I'm sure our Department of International Relations and Cooperation and the Minister, you know, have their own program of work around this. So one could link, you know, obviously one would link with them. Right, I think. Thank you for your indulgence, Chairperson.
Thank you, Mr. Nodier. Mr. Nodier is from WWF. Welcome those members who have just, you can switch off your mic. Welcome those members that have just joined us. This is the first session of the three sessions take place tomorrow and gather tomorrow. Tomorrow and Friday. What Parliament has done is it opened up an opportunity for all members for training, for conversation of what the issues are in climate change. We are hosting, as we all know, as a country, and then again as members of Parliament, we have a role that we must identify for ourselves. It is indeed our workshop, so to speak. So we should really make it our workshop. The steering committee that we have consists of a number of committees thus far. They range from finance, environment, water committee, energy, and then of course I think the rural development and culture, to agriculture, forestry, fisheries. I'm not sure if I'm missing any. But I must say, because matters are quite cross-cutting, as we're listening to Mrs. Nodier, we easily can hear her without having said that we also could be bracing for ourselves for all sorts of wars that could otherwise be there. So defense is not therefore also played a very key and important role in really protecting any scenarios of such nature developing. Members, we have listened to Mrs. Nodier. As I was saying, this is our workshop, and this time is for us to make questions or present questions or comments for us to get a better understanding of what the issues asked that were given. The floor is ours, General for the Minister.
Chairperson, honourable members, and ladies and gentlemen, I think as a host country, we need to approach this issue carefully and be open about it, not try and pretend that we are in control of the situation. We need to come strong statement to the effect that this country is 16, 17 years new in the international arena. South Africa has been isolated because of the previous policy. And as a result, we lost a lot of time in terms of developing our technology. So, when we say we think by 2020 we would have reduced certain or addressed some of the problems, but we need to have an introduction in our paper, discussion document, or a preamble to the effect that we must not be seen as if we do not toe the line, but we are trying to catch up. This country's technology is lagging far behind. I'll make an example, for instance, and I think Ms. Nogier will confirm this. The Green Development Mechanism, called CDM, many countries outside South Africa are gaining from the fund an amount of about 120 billion rand last year. Was claimed by 3,000 companies worldwide where they gain carbon credits. But I guess in South Africa, not more than 25 companies have submitted claims. Either they don't know anything about this. I also went to SALCA conference a few weeks ago, and I could see that, notice that South Africans, including councillors, business people were there. They know little about this carbon, this climate change debate. So there is a lot of work which we need to do. Either before the COP17, we could target a two-day session where we bring all South Africans of, like, MP, public reps, labor, business, under one group, to say, this is where we are going and what are our recommendations. Because currently, this situation is very haphazard. We don't know what is the position of the country. And I hope that the DECO, Department of International Relations, would come here and brief us. What will be their position? What informs their position in this negotiation? Otherwise, we will be a laughing stock when we begin to attack one another in front of the guests of Britain. Thank you.
I want to deal with because I believe this is the parliamentary responsibility is to insist that the leaders that everybody was talking about after the World Cup, 2010 World Cup, should be a key focus on the legacy of the hosting of the COP17 conference in Durban. Because I do not understand, even though we are not going to be spending the kind of money that we were spending towards the 2010 World Cup, but there has to be a refocusing of our budget on those matters that would have to benefit the vulnerable, the poor, that Mr. D is talking about. And I'm thinking about four areas that I think should be the parliamentary responsibility to pursue in a focused way. Maybe Honorable Olumisa is correct that our position in the world should be protected. Perhaps, yes, we need to avoid embarrassing ourselves by creating an impression that we do not know whether we're coming or going. But I think the bigger embarrassment is when we neglect the people in South Africa and focus on the public relations exercise international. And I don't believe that those two things should be mutually exclusive, but I think there has to be a focus of members of parliament on the South African citizens. If you read what Mrs. Nodia has been saying together with what has been said about MDGs in South Africa, about what Dr. Swaliti was talking about when he was presenting the scenario on health prevalence, especially AIDS in South Africa, you will see that the most vulnerable are getting more and more vulnerable. Ms. Nodia, perhaps you are aware, and General Minister will agree with me on this one, the overcrowding in little spaces in the bandstand have created the soil erosion to an extent that it is not possible to equilibrium in those areas. Therefore, food security is not a future threat, it is a current threat. And there's not much money spent on the repairing. Because if you're talking about the repairing and the defending of the ecosystem, I don't believe that the focus should purely be on wetlands or endangered species. That is an important area to be defended and protected. But the current existence of people in overcrowding conditions in Balistan with nowhere to plow and produce food because of soil erosion, and even currently the damming of the huge dams in the Balistan area is not a priority. And therefore you cannot even repair fields to produce food. And I think that it will therefore be a red herring to talk about sustainable development if you don't talk about the existing conditions of those people in the rural areas, in particular in Palestine areas. And I think Parliament, when we look at the carbon budget, we should not be looking at the generation of energy, the transportation emissions and so on, without looking at what can be done immediately in these rural areas and reduce overcrowding and reduce the damage on the ecosystem because of this overcrowding. And I'm told WWF has influence over other NGOs and environmentalists that are anti-fracking in the Karoo, anti-N2 in the Mangodwe, anti-titanium mining, coloring, and so on. And because of that, I think they could form a partnership with us so that we say, how do we then assist the achievement of the defense and the repairing of the ecosystem by defending the vulnerable in this area. At the same time, make sure that if fracking will take place, we must see a guarantee now that that fracking should not damage the water in the country. If colony mining takes place, we should make sure that it takes place under conditions that will not damage the environment in that area. So I think we should not have an either-or scenario. We should have a teamwork to defend these things from further damage, but at the same time make sure that the people's economic conditions are improved. Because not only are these people voters, but they are the citizens of this country the same way as those people are all able to switch air conditioning when it gets hot. And they are not protected and prioritized in the same way because they do not have a voice, they are not organized. And we as the public left, we should be intervening in this regard to make sure that this climate change, COP17 hosting West Africa, benefits them better than it will benefit the companies that will claim carbon credits. because those companies can withstand even, they do not collapse by not claiming those carbon credits. Whereas the people die every day from AIDS, and the SDGs are not improving, in fact they are degenerating. And that is where the money should go to. Thank you.
By 2010, the legacy that was left by SOCAM was on the infrastructure and all what it took. When we are now hosting 2011, COP17, the question there is what legacy will leave behind, especially for those vulnerable ones. I guess that's a point raised by Mr. Sidana. I have Mama Ramsay question. Ramsay, sorry. I've noticed a few hands. May we allow I'm not sure how we want to run this particular workshop. I saw other hands raising from the front row. I will just go cover the room, okay?
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I want to take note of the page that talks about agricultural productivity shift. And Louise mentioned that the red part indicates scarcity. I also have an understanding that there was some research done in South Africa that indicates, especially in areas around Eastern Cape, how fertile that land is in terms of agriculture. Perhaps those organizations, including governments, that have get funding for such methods of climate change, their assistance in those areas, I think Mr. Susan as well mentioned erosion, that those areas, in my understanding, they are fertile for productivity, but in many areas are not used effectively, and that would assist in actually in agriculture. The second issue I want to raise, Chair, is something that we as members of Parliament, through you, Chair, that we must really take up. In international forums like WTO, COP17, there you find executives discussing and taking decisions. And in other countries like US, you find members of Parliament on the side advising their own ministers or maybe somehow participating, not necessarily in decisions, but in the processes. I think it is something we as South African Parliament should take it serious, because at the end, those agreements they do, we have to pass them in Parliament, whereas we were not part of the whole process. And I think it's something we can stop as members of Parliament in all the countries or continue with it. And I think, Chair, through you, it's something we need to take so that we are not engaged at the end tail of these agreements as members of Parliament, because we can influence, starting from SADC, going to Africa, and going to all the South countries. It's something that we must take a decision as members of Parliament of South Africa. I think Ms. Njika is going to come to international. We need to know China is regarded, I don't know, as developing, but is one of the most producing in terms of emissions. Where is it put in terms of this, in terms of these emissions, and how does it get influenced in actually also contributing in these countries? Because we can see how China enters all these developing countries now with all its equipment and that, and how they actually contribute enormously in these emissions. I think we need to actually hear from that when she gives an input. Thank you, Ken.
We have a Mama, you want to give us
something? Yeah, thanks, Chairperson, and I would also like to welcome the presentation. Chairperson, now, if we look at the SDG 1, where we say to eradicate extreme poverty, I was thinking that why has the South African government, we have got so many people who are not working, like Omahlalela Zemakhanda. If we can say
if you plow a tree, you'll be able to get this carbon credit. But you find that even the people are in the rural areas, they can be able to participate in fighting this greenhouse emission. If we can say those people are not working, if you can plow so many trees and we check that you've done it, we will be able to credit you with some money or with some resources so that you can be able to make a living out of that work. As we know that there are so many people are not working, but seemingly the sustaining will wait up to 2035. If we can start by doing small things now, although we are continuing with our industries and all that to try to produce. Secondly, I had last time, I'm not sure whether it's still better, as we are having coal here as the main mineral to produce energy. Can't we have our science to have something which will make coal not to emit so much carbon, to try to work on coal, because we can't say let's do away with coal, but if we can say we are going to have a mechanism of making coal not to emit so much, or even if it emits, but we have a way of absorbing that carbon. Thanks.
Thank you, Jason. I'm Mary Shin from the Science and Technology Portfolio Committee. I'd like to, Ms. Mavis, please just give us some idea whether there are any discussions in place for introducing the global change charters to South African industry and government for when they actually sign deals on infrastructure development projects. Should we have some sort of incentives, some sort of conditions that need to be worked into major contracts with governments that they actually will commit to various mitigating factors or emission preventative measures, sort of almost like the BE charters, whether we should perhaps introduce something like that in any government.
Mamadouza?
I think my response is probably and then taking a risk of some, and said something that has been presented. I'm raising this within the context of what General Golovitsa said and Mrs. Zan, because I don't want to talk about it. Also, I'm Linda Rafferty from Science and Technology. As I'm listening and looking into this document, and this being a subject of people that have got knowledge on issues of climate change, like ourselves. But the unfortunate part is that people that affected the most are those that are poor, are those that are ignorant, not because of their choice. And then my question is, as we will be involved, I'm hoping that by attending this workshop, we are being empowered to ensure that we assist the communities. As parliament, as government, we assist more as members of parliament. When we go to our constituency areas, we make people to understand what is this and what impact is it having to them. And therefore, my question to you then is that how best can we ensure that we simplify the whole process of costing? Maybe we certainly government will also be able to answer. But my fear is even people that are going to attend there are people that are going to come and bring people to women in rural areas, and therefore can we maybe, I'm posing to ask the members of parliament that we really hit the ground running by simplifying goals to people, empower them so that they understand. Even that young boy, girl, and boy and girl side in the school understand what is this? What impact is it going to have in her or him in the next 10 or 20 or 5 years for that matter? Because it's not something that is going to happen. It's not going to happen. It has been happening since yesterday. The last question is, I have been in Johannesburg for the last 10 years, and when you go to Soweto in winter, you feel that there is a cloud, it's going to rain. It's only that cold. They're using coal. Is there a process that has been put in place to empower them so that they understand what is then going to take place? The last question, which may be it's a comment, is that how then do we ensure as members of parliament that this process, but if it is not guided, if we don't manage it as members of parliament, not to go political points, but to empower the people of South Africa and of Africa. How can we ensure that it is not used? It's political and ideological in nature, issue of climate change. How can we ensure that we don't use it to go political points, but to ensure that our concerns about the plight of the poor and the vulnerable, women and children in particular. Those are the comments, Chair, that I wanted to make. That's why my first was so my apologies if I'm ready since that has been raised. Thank you.
Very relevant point, Mama Tunja, can say to say so. Again, the point here is, as I listen, the health have no means. If any, very little. The have no meaning. If any, but very little. And they have everything to defend themselves from any disaster. We've just had a situation, a very recent, I think last week or two, in Manhattan, where in the hurricane storms were approaching. And it became very clear that those people there, they had every means to defend themselves. But in Haiti, those people were simply just left all there by themselves, exposed, so to speak, to all of the disasters. And we know what happened there. There are a number of activities that are going on. Points being made by General Lomis are very valid. About, of course, you will respond to all of those. But there are a number of excuses, and I wanted to mention as well, I think I did mention earlier on, Mr. Jigela and I have also expected to present here a program and some elements of the program that our members of parliament are expected to be involved in. Among others, I'm not sure that there's a seminar that is supposed to be hosted by parliament that invites society in general. And that is a parliamentary-led program. There are a number of other programs. As we speak today, ministers in Africa are seated in Johannesburg, hosted by Agriculture, Forestry and Fisheries. Once again, dealing with this very issue that we're talking about on climate change, but from an agriculture point of view. Okay, I think let's take both of you and then you respond and then we comment later on. Can we have her and then come back to you, Mama? Okay, thanks.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think, as you said, it's the Honourable Member's own workshop. People are making wonderful debating points and contributions. I don't think I need to respond to them. It's not for me. But I will maybe make some points of information. So, Honourable Holomisa,
there's a lot of opportunities actually in these international forums and negotiations for us to access various kinds of funds. And I mean, there are some criticisms, for example, of the Clean Development Mechanism, but we at WWF would say, look, there must be weaknesses, there must be problems, we've got to try and put safeguards in against those things, but let us use this opportunity. So there's the CDM, and I agree that the challenge is how to see, how to access those kinds of funds for the poor and vulnerable, as opposed to just Anglo-American or something, or shouldn't abuse them. But, you know, it doesn't have, those funds do not need to be accessed for more profit. They need to be accessed for the poor and vulnerable. There's also the adaptation fund set up under the Kyoto Protocol. And one of the issues at COP17 will be to try and advance that adaptation fund. Very little money has flowed into it from the developed countries, and very few countries have managed to access funds. And then there's the new Green Fund that Minister Manuel is co-chairing the committee that's trying to look into those things. So all of those are opportunities. And I was very excited yesterday to see that our, because to access these opportunities, a country has to have something called a national implementing entity, which is able to receive those funds and then make decisions about how they should be dispersed within the country. And the South African National Biodiversity Institute was very recently appointed the national implementing entity for the adaptation fund money. So that, to me, was very exciting. The issue about that in our country, the challenge is the developmental challenges. I mean, I think everybody's making those points, and all I can do is underline them. So, you know, people in rural areas, women, the poor. I would argue that climate change is also land issues. You know, it's getting land to people so that they can see, look after themselves and feed themselves. So the whole land question comes into this. And then, thank you for, Honourable Suzanne, for correcting me that food insecurity is not a coming challenge, it's right now. Many people are going to be hungry. Many people can't feed their children by the end of the month. And what I want to say is that commercial agriculture, the way we're conducting it at the moment, is not necessarily the best way to go. It uses huge amounts of energy, huge amounts of water. There's got to be a different way of doing agriculture. There are practices which are called conservation agriculture, where you don't, for example, plow. There's different ways of dealing with that. I'm not an expert in agriculture, but I know there are colleagues who talk about this. So that you're not, we don't have to follow the developmental path of the North that has been so disastrous for the Earth. There really are alternative development paths which can provide a better life for all. Okay, then on the question of government charters. It's a wonderful idea. I've never thought about it. And I mean, I'm sure you'll continue to raise it in the House. And perhaps those charters could be around things like the allocation of the carbon budget. And certainly, allocation of the carbon budget, quite right, it's not about transport and waste and energy. It's about services to people. So how are we going to use that carbon budget to deliver decent transport services to people, decent housing, decent energy services? Certainly, it really is about uplifting the most poor and most vulnerable. In terms of the geopolitics that Mumpy raised, those from Department of International Relations and the Minister will be much more qualified on this, but definitely, countries go into those negotiations with their own interests at heart and their own agendas around economic, political and, you know, geopolitical issues. So certainly one has to look at why does the United States refuse to come and make commitments.
why has China got the position it has, the role of China in the world, certainly. And I think it's very important, the issue of this whole arena has been made into an arena for experts. So experts like to talk to each other in all sorts of jargon, you know, you're an expert at sea, cock, namas, nafas, all these things. And really, I always feel that issues are not complex. You know, people make them complex with all this jargon. But really, any human being can understand these issues if one goes to them in a way that speaks to their conditions and their issues. So, I don't know if that helps as comments on some of the issues raised. And, Chairperson, you raised the issue of New York versus Haiti. I mean, even if one looks at, for example, what happened in New Orleans with the flood, that in a developed country context, and who suffered there? You know, rich people could get themselves out. Poor people were stuck there on roofs of houses. And their own government has not come to their rescue. So within, you know, there's always a class division in every society, and it's always the poor who bear the brunt. So, and then that same relation plays itself out between countries. So we see in Somalia, you know, in a developed country, nobody would be starving like that as a result of a drought. So, yeah, just to underline your point.
Okay, we'll take only three hands now, because we don't want to disrupt the lagging in terms of time. I can't see the hand there. I cannot really manage to identify myself and then I saw you in trouble. Mama, sorry, I'm not sure whether you want to comment now or maybe as you do your introduction, you also might wish to.
Thank you, Chair. I raised my hand because I wanted to just pick up on two points which I may not cover in my input. And I want to apologize to Ms. Nodier because I don't normally respond when I'm part of the team that is presenting. I don't think it's professional. But I thought I may miss those points if I don't pick them up now. They are more factual issues. One is that the signatories to the Kyoto Protocol include 52 countries from Africa. I think the AU took a resolution to support the Kyoto Protocol. I think it's important because that's what makes us stronger as Africa. We morally, we are stronger because we signed the Kyoto Protocol. That's the first issue. The second one is around the CDM. The issue about the CDM are the rules and regulations which are very onerous and very difficult, making it very difficult for people to access the programs of the CDM and the funding and everything. And I think it's an issue that needs to be raised. Conference, it must constitute part of the resolution of Parliament that the CDM must be accessible. Otherwise, we will continue to experience that problem. But also, there is an effort by Africa. Africa has established what they call African Policy Center on Climate Change. And some of these matters will be dealt with within that center, and it will be important for South Africa to get away with such establishment that will help, you know, deal with some of these problems. I thought I should raise only those two. I'll come back to your China later. I think there's something that I've prepared for that. Thank you very much, sir. I'm sorry to come in again. I won't come in again.
Thank you, Mama. There are six numbers. I think you'll agree with me on that one. Mama, you had your hand up.
Thank you, Chairperson. My name is Sana Flaiki from the Science and Technology Portfolio Committee. We are
Chapter 10, as I'm sitting here listening to the members, I'm really a bit worried, thinking about your sphere very closer to the ordinary people, which is your local government sphere. You are asking yourself, since this is our first lecture, when and how are we going to get this type of information to them? Because those are the people that had to sit on a day-to-day and plan on the lives of those ordinary people. The type of planning that they are doing, especially when they deal with their budget, when you look at their budget, they say it's for a disaster management something. It's so little, you ask yourself, what type of disaster are we talking about? And you look at the type of the natural disasters that are taking place these days, a huge amount of money to assist. What role can we as parliament play to capacitate your local spheres of government in order for them, when they start to plan, then they start to plan for proper stuff. The ordinary men and women on the street know about disasters, but taking them along on your planning platform is what is needed, so that they can also voice out and plan for their own area, so that by the time the disaster happens in the area, they know what to do. So they should plan prior together with the local government. So you find that sometimes local government seem to plan for proper stuff because of the lack of funds. Then they plan for smaller things like it's raining. A lot of work are going to be done at a certain area. We must be able to remove or do whatever is needed to be done. It's not much that is being done. So if maybe we can try to speed up this type of program to reach the local government level, so that then also can start programs to educate members in community. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Excuse me, I'm Denise Robinson from the Women, Children and Persons with Disabilities. I just want to follow on from what Honourable Hulamisa said about Parliament taking the lead and perhaps getting all spheres of government under one roof and speaking about this. I agree, but yet I disagree. I don't think we can all get under one roof. I think what should be initiated here is that a program goes out to national, provincial and local government, and that we make this our business as parliamentarians, as people who have constituencies whose fingers reach out into the communities, whether it is in the cities or in villages or in urban areas, that we are able to spread this message as well. It's through churches, it's through schools, creches, communities. If we can get the education focus between now and December to looking at something basic, like what can we do in our homes? The City of Cape Town has recently launched a program in the area where I live, where they have a pilot project where we are sorting our refuse. We are far behind other countries where they have separate bins for plastics, for paper, for whatever. And if we can teach young people from an early age to sort and to consider the natural products and how one can avoid waste and one can recycle, I think there needs to be a far greater awareness. You said there is a lot of poverty and people who are poor suffer most. You're quite correct, but I want to say there's also poverty of knowledge. And this is where the education comes in, through formal and informal education. And if we can just get people to understand the necessity of planting trees, and I just want to say how important the speck worm is. I don't know if you're aware of it, but it's something which grows all over, it's drought resistant, but it helps to restore the balance. And if each one of us can launch something between now and December and onwards, just to create this information, I think we will be making a major difference. So it's everybody's business. It's not an intellectual thing, although it can be, and it is basically how do we bring our children up and our young people and retrain older people who've got into bad ways. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I wanted to assist. There was a question in
you. You are in the last, and then we wrap up on this.
There was a question asked here, Chairperson, about the coal, which caused a lot of damage in areas like Soweto. South Africa exports coal to the European countries and other countries, but those countries always tell South African companies, not in my backyard. Don't come and dump your rubbish in my backyard. That forces the local coal companies to export clean coal. But if you go to Soweto, those people are burning just a raw, dirty coal. Question is, whose responsibility is to clean that coal? That the companies who are selling this coal, or should the state subsidize part of the prices? That's a matter which needs to be debated. As far as the question of creating awareness, I'm part of an initiative here called the Champions of the Environment Foundation. We are busy negotiating now with the Department of Education, Basic Education, Department of Environment, as well as some big companies, with a view to start a National Youth Environment Orators Competition, where we will have an annual topic, whether it's about climate change, it's on waste management, and at the end of the year, then those students will compete towards the end, and then they will be given, say, 10 or 15 people be given bursaries in the future to go and study in environmental science and so on. As far as the tree planting is concerned, again, this Champions of Environment Foundation is working with the private sector, the State Department. Last year we launched that project in the Eastern Cape. This past Saturday, Sunday, we were at a new organic place in Kwanongoma, where we planted 34,000 indigenous trees, being guided by the people who do soil tests and carbon measurements and so on. The aim is that the companies will be encouraged to go and buy those trees. And part of the money must go directly to the trust of those communities. Those are the kinds of initiatives which we need to intensify for this country. Not just to theorize and theorize.
Once again, at the risk of further theorizing, as Parliament, when we came back from Cancun last year, we impressed upon the institution to really begin to talk about charity beginning at home. Stop being further theorizing by greening Parliament and our own areas where we live. You have companies that are prepared, of course, at the best. I mean, on the upside of it all, they would be looking at getting those carbon credits. But they would wish to come and install the technologies here. And also in the areas where we live. And also, nothing stops really from government departments and all of our efforts to really go green. The risk of being the dark green revolutionaries here. Now, these are issues that are supposed to be simple and straightforward without being much of theorizing. Once again, the will issue comes in. Now, we are further exposed that working in silos has continued to be a normal practice. local, provincial, and national spheres of government are areas that are supposed to be brought on board on a matter that is cross-cutting, like the one that we're dealing with. I mean, these are some of the messages that are coming out. Okay, Mr. Sondhia, you did indicate the fact that, you know, you are not necessarily expected to bring responses per se. These are comments, and equally these are questions, and also I would imagine that we should also take it upon ourselves as and when a question arises that any of us can respond to that particular question. Let us thank Mrs. Nodier. I'm sure you are going to still sit around and listen to other presentations to come. Okay, we are now going to listen to Mama, our own Sondika, who will take us through having had an experience herself being, you know, directly involved in these negotiations at the highest level. We'll listen to her and then take it from there on the view on international response to some change and lessons that she went through.
Thank you very much, Tim. Let me take this opportunity to express my appreciation to yourself for inviting me to share some of the knowledge. Not much, but I think it is some little thing that I can share with you from the deployment that you gave me in South Africa. I want to start by saying that a disclaimer that Minister Mulewa knows that I interact with Parliament. I decided to inform him. I think it's important that I do that. So now and again we interact and she's informed that I'm sharing this knowledge with you. Let me, before I get into my input, pick up one issue on local government. That local government actually is exposed to this debate. The last time I knew environmental affairs, together with the provincial and local government, traditional affairs, department, both work together to ensure that the issue of climate change, disaster management is understood by local government. To the extent that there is an act on air quality, which is already being implemented by local government. So local government is on board. I think the issue and the message that I'm getting here, this hand does not know what the other hand is doing. I think there needs to be more integration so that we can have a sense of the total sum of efforts that we have embarked on, which will also give us, you know, the product from all of those collective efforts. And for me, the issue is really integration. I have, getting into my input, I'm starting by what I call basic facts. Firstly, climate change is not an isolated phenomenon, especially the management of climate change. It is a central aspect of the broader environmental agenda. So when you implement the National Environmental Management Act, the Biodiversity Act, in a way, you are dealing, you are managing the effects of climate change. And the environmental agenda is about sustainable growth and development. I think we all know that. And for me, what is important for us is what Comrade Stone raised. That this is not about taking the extreme position, which sometimes we as, you know, people who have different interests in society would be tempted to take the extreme view that we think should be the one that is pushed. So for me, sustainable growth, and this is how I understand it, is about coexistence of development and management and environmental management. It can't be either or. The country must develop, but in the process, the country cannot sacrifice and the environment. The country must manage the environment, but at the same time, the country cannot sacrifice development. That's my understanding of sustainable development. But at times, we go for the extreme, you know, as people with different interests. And if you did, that would be dangerous for the country. I think for me, the middle ground is what is important. You know, the teacher who trained me, I was a teacher, trained me, used to say to us as students, we want the easy way out. I think the reason why we take the extreme view, we want the easy way out. We don't want to be creative in terms of finding a solution that would bring the two developments coexisting with the environment. So, Professor, you will mine, but you will mine in a way that will ensure that you manage the environment. I think that's one point that I want to make on this one. The debate on climate change is informed by scientific evidence. I think we all know that, contained in what they call the fourth assessment report of the IPCC. IPCC standing for International Panel on Climate Change, which assess that the temperatures are rising. I think Ms. Nodier alluded to this. And now we have to reduce the temperatures to remain at the level of 2 degrees. That's a view from other countries, developing countries. But the most vulnerable states, like your Bangladesh, who are about to disappear because of the problem of climate change, they are saying 2 degrees, no way, 1.5. Even within Africa, there is that view. But we try to manage that to the extent that we agreed at 2 degrees when we put together the position for Africa. But there's still that noise that maybe 1.5 degrees. The cause for the rise in temperatures is carbon emissions from human activities. It has been alluded to. Electricity generation from coal and so on. The cars we drive, the fires we burn, and by the way, the people who burn fires in Soweto, the Department of Environment, under the leadership of the Deputy Minister, is running a program called Basa Njengo Magogo. I'm told that that program, which teaches people how to put up the fire, helps to mitigate the emission from fire. I don't know how scientific that has been proven, but this is what is happening in the department. So there are some programs within the department that are meant to target these. The effects of climate change as experienced today are a legacy of 150 years of industrialization, which happened and benefited about 34 countries, what is called the OECD countries. And this included all of what we're doing today. They also generated electricity, they had cars, they were burning fires, all of the things that we're doing today, they did those 150 years ago. So what is happening today, part of the response that I'm giving to Mandy, what is happening today in China will impact on us 50 years down the line. It's said now, it can't take as long as it has taken with industrialization. So the impact of the emissions of China will happen around 50 years. At that time, China would have to lead in terms of its mitigating contribution for the reduction of emissions at that time. If we follow this debate as it is happening now, because the message that we're sending to the developed countries is that this is a consequence of your development. So you have to lead us in terms of your contribution to reducing these emissions, because you benefited and we did not benefit. Now, those who will be there, I'll be very dead, I know that. Those who will be there should say that to China that you led in the emissions. That is 50 years, your child and my child, or my, your grandchild and my grandchild will have to say that to China. The developing world, G77, contributed less to the creation of climate change as we experience it today, with Africa being the lead contributor while remaining the most vulnerable of all continents. I think that's a fact that we all know about. I've also then decided to talk about the structure of the negotiations. Who is in the negotiations? The negotiations, I think what is important, what I forgot there, which is very important, is that the negotiations are under the auspices of the United Nations. So it's the United Nations that is the host for these negotiations. And then there's a legal framework that has been created over time. So I'll just pick up what is relevant today. One is the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, the Kyoto Protocol, the Bali Action Plan, and the Fourth Assessment Report, which I alluded to earlier on. That is the legal framework within which this debate is being pursued. Formal parties, I had this United Nations thing under two. Formal parties for negotiations. These formal parties, I refer to them as formal parties because this is the arrangement or the organization suggested by the United Nations or under the United Nations. You have countries are grouped into two before you then group the G77. It's G77 by China, and then you have your developed countries. And this is how they come into this debate. We come in as G77 plus China and developing countries. And that is reflected in the responsibilities that we must take. If you look at the Bali Action Plan or the UNFCCC, it says developed countries must take targets on mitigation, whereas developing countries must take actions on mitigation. So that's the differentiation that they have given using that grouping of the United Nations. However, there are informal parties within the negotiations. For instance, you have the Major Economies Forum, which was established by the former President of the United States of America, President Bush. This constitutes 17 plus countries, because it has now affected other countries which were not originally there. These are regarded as the biggest emitters of the world. Unfortunately, our country is one of those countries. We are included in that top 17. So we should be proud if we were in a class of men, but I don't think this one is something that we can be proud of, because this is not a class of men. Okay, let me then respond to Mande. Why is then China part of the developing world when it is growing, its economy is growing at the rate that it is growing to, even threaten the power scheme? Because at some point there was a view that it has actually taken over from the powerhouse of the United States of America. Why then is it still regarded as a... I'm not sure if this is the best answer, but this is my understanding of it. I think it is because of its social and economic status. The Gini coefficient, while I do not know it, but I think that Gini coefficient, which is what is used to measure whether a country is developed or developing, it still places China at the level of a developing country. In other words, how much do you spend for a poor person? Or how much do you spend for a person in a country? So that kind of thing, they call it Gini coefficient, is what determines then the strength of the economy, or yes, whether it's weak or strong, that's what it determines. I've already said that also this is about the legacy. We are dealing with the legacy of industrialization, and China did not benefit from that industrialization. So that's one other thing that could be the reason why China is still kept as a developing country. But then also, China is not yet fully developed by all means. It's still on course of developing. So all of those three reasons are, for me, are the reasons that I think are putting China at the level of a developing country. The basic group has already been alluded to: Brazil, South Africa, India, and China. These countries are seen to be leaders in the emerging economy. You know, within the developing world, we lead in terms of our growth, in terms of our emissions. So as these four countries, we decided to put together this group because there's some common interest. We face a common challenge. We are similar in terms of our socio-economic situation, although it's not a homogeneous group. I mean, Brazil is stronger, China is stronger, India is stronger than us. But there are similarities. So we decided to have this group. So some kind of a caucus group that would help us reflect on issues directly affecting us. African Ministers Committee on Environment, again, this is the structure in Africa. It's a ministerial body of ministers, as indicated. What is important about this, again, in terms of our vulnerabilities, we again differ. And it also reflects, if you look at the character of the countries that are there, it reflects the fact that Africa is the poorest continent in the world. 34 countries in Africa are least developed. 34. So it tells you beyond a doubt that we are very vulnerable. But then when it comes to us relating to Africa, as a powerhouse in Africa, we are the biggest emitter. Mr. Odier has already alluded to that. It's quite right. Of the 4% that Africa contributes to the total sum of emissions in the world, 2% comes from South Africa. And there is an issue about that in Africa, because Africa says, we can't treat you as a developing country because you are bigger than us. Now, this is a continental politic. That South Africa actually should be taking a target, just like America and other OECD countries. And we as South Africa say, no way, we are a developing country. And we never benefited from industrialization. After all, we're still doing when all of these things happened, we were colonized. So there's no way that you can ask us to carry the burden of people that benefited from a certain process that we did. So there is that argument, which is one of the reasons why they would not want 2 degrees, a drop to these least developed countries in Africa, actually saying 1.5, and South Africa must take more. So there's that policy even within Africa, which is very important for us to stay very close and be part of the activities within Africa. Again, another dynamic within Africa, there are oil-producing countries within Africa. They have their own agenda, and their own interests. So there is no homogeneity, although we are Africa, but there's no homogeneity. It's a pot of diverse interests in as far as development and climate change are concerned. In South Africa, this debate is led by cabinet, rightfully so. It leads to negotiations, and we as parliament, we pass, we ratify, we do oversight. I will come back to that. I just was trying to present the structure and then narrow it down to what is happening in our country. Now, I've never really approached the issue of climate change from a scientific perspective because I'm not a scientist. I know a little bit about politics, but not science. So my input, I'm sure you'll appreciate it, will be focusing more on political issues, which sometimes present themselves as legal issues. The first issue is that all countries have a responsibility, and that's common knowledge. We all have a responsibility to do something about climate change. And almost all are committed to the reduction of greenhouse emissions. That almost is the operative word there, because not all. If you look at the countries like Venezuela, there's reluctance there. Bolivia, there's reluctance there. You know, so all of those countries, they are not quite comfortable with climate change. So you can't say that all of them, all countries are covered, 192 countries, or 193 now, are committed to it. But almost all, the majority of the countries, are committed to the reduction of greenhouse emissions. It is also common knowledge that developed countries are more responsible for the creation of the problem, why they are also better poised to make a bigger contribution to combating the effects of climate change. Now, this is determined, I've already alluded to it, by the strength of their economy, but also it determines the strength of the economies of the weaker countries. I mean, it applies that for me, methodology which I've just thought about applies to all countries. What you can do is determined by how capable you are. But the approach then has been that we must share the responsibility of reducing the emissions in a fair and equitable manner. I think I want to repeat this. The approach has been to share the responsibility in a fair and equitable manner. The reason I'm repeating this is at the core of the negotiation. What complicates the negotiation is this issue of sharing the responsibility in a fair and equitable manner. But then whoever wrote these UNFCCC, the Bali Action Plan, I think they were wise enough to agree that in order for us to share, to have this fairness and equity in contributing, whether we're mitigating or we're putting money, but in order for us to achieve it, we must adopt a principle. And the principle of common but differentiated responsibilities and capabilities under the UNFCCC and the Bali Action Plan is the one then that guides that fairness in the contribution of all nations of the world. Developed countries, according to the Bali Action, must take targets to mitigate against climate change, while developing countries must commit to actions to mitigate. Well, with taking targets, it's kind of compelled. It has an element of saying you are compelled to mitigate as a developed country. Whereas with developing countries, it's kind of saying, yes, you can do something because all of us, we are common because we're all vulnerable. So all of us must do something.
But we are not as compelled in terms of taking bigger targets like the developing countries. I mean, the developed countries are. I think the issue here is the consideration of the fact that the developed countries benefited from industrialization that gave us what we are going through today. But the major issue then in dealing with all of what I've raised there is to find a legally binding regime that will make all countries contribute. All countries must contribute, and that includes us. And this is why I'm emphasizing, because I don't want people to misunderstand that when I'm saying developing countries did not contribute, did not benefit from industrialization, it doesn't mean that they are off the hook when it comes to us having to work together as a collective to deal with climate change, all of us. But then there must be a legally binding regime that will make all countries contribute. Again, if you have Venezuela saying that we are not so interested, if there is no legally binding regime, then there may be a problem, because you can't make them account. And I'm not sure if you can make them account even if there would be a legally binding, because monitoring the implementation of that is another issue, which maybe is the reason why countries like Russia would be pushing for, you know what, leave us alone in Russia. Let us do our thing here in Russia. We will deal with climate change. We don't want to be part of this legally binding or whatever regime that is there. Leave us to have our own program. That's what Russia is saying. But again, Russia may emit as much as it wants, because there's nobody who's monitoring or who's measuring that those emissions. So then the legally binding regime must then ensure that countries report in a manner that can be verified. That's the big issue that the negotiations are about. Now, there are complexities which we discovered about within the negotiations. The first one, all countries go into negotiations wanting to protect their national interests. It doesn't matter which country it is. We go there knowing that in Ebulebu there are people who do not have electricity. We go there with that. And when I'm told about reducing the emissions, I think about the energy poverty. So those things are mandates that we carry into the negotiations. And it's not only South Africa. Now, there's been a call that we must stop using coal. Stop, I would not support, but reduce the dependence, I would support. Because America is using 51% coal in its electricity generation. So stopping cannot happen, but reducing the dependence over time, I would support. We can't just be abrupt, because we still have challenges like this energy poverty that I'm talking about. Now, also, we go to China. China, one of the things that, maybe I'm trying to watch my mouth here. One of the things that are a problem, okay, let me say this because it's going to free me. One of the issues that are a problem between China and the U.S., or let's say the developed and the developing countries, and not the and leave out countries, is this thing of international trade competitiveness. Now, one of the reasons why we have there's a stalemate, kind of, there is a stalemate within the negotiations, is that China will not move to do certain things. There's this thing they call measuring verifiable and reportable, MRV. It's measurable, reportable, and verifiable. That means then you must report in a way that will inform the world that is what we are doing about climate change. China is refusing because that's going to drive to it having to open its national development agenda, and it's refusing. Because you can't deal with climate change without having incorporated it in your national development plan. It has to be part of that national development plan. So what the point that I'm making here, although countries will make compromises, but they refuse to give away what they think is vital for their economy. The second point, combating climate change leads to a review to the national development plan of any country. That is the fact. That's why we're talking about, Comrade there, talking about why are we not, you not using clean technology? Yes, if we want to use coal, then we must look at, if we want to use coal and reduce the emissions, we must then look at clean coal technology, which is what countries are now looking at. But when you do that, there is information from what they call the Pew International Center on Climate Change. It says, if you then, the technology now, as we speak, that helps to clean the coal and reduce the emissions, will increase your electricity cost by 35%. And some of these things are not communicated. And I'm raising all of these things because I think as members of parliament, it's important to interrogate these things. Not because you don't want to your country, but I think it's important that my sense is that we are just on the receiving end. We get all of this information, we comply, we don't interrogate. We don't get all the stories. The story that goes out is not a political story. It's not a story that's a social story. It's not a story, an economic story, and as to how the climate change issue will impact on your economy. So I'm saying it's important that we interrogate this. Developed countries see combating the effects of climate change as a major priority, while developing countries see poverty and pollution as their major priority. That's the fact. But again, we have to be creative in terms of how we manage that. When you, for instance, I like the exercise that Bantu said. When you plant a tree, you involve people. Ne? And when you involve those people, you give them something. So you take poor people, they benefit from planting those trees. But in the process, one tree gives off oxygen for 40 people, cleaning the environment for you. At the same time, it takes in carbon dioxide. So I'm saying you have combined. This is what I'm saying, talking about when I talk about coexistence of development and climate change management. Because we are dealing with this one. So you are dealing with poverty as well as dealing with the effects of climate change. Because of their vulnerability, developing countries think that adaptation should take precedence over mitigation. And with developed countries, the opposite is true. I think Lulu alluded to this, and I cannot say more about it. That's very important. There is an expectation from the developed world that the developing countries, especially the emerging economies, must carry a bigger burden in mitigation. It comes from my own experience, and I mean, these are the arguments that we had when we were students. Within the developed world, the countries that are signatories to the Kyoto Protocol are actually opposed to its second commitment. And I'm talking even about the Scandinavian countries. They don't want to see the second commitment of the Kyoto Protocol because they are saying, we committed, we were signatories, we did something in terms of our carbon emissions, but the U.S. was left off the hook because it was not part of the Kyoto Protocol. It was not a signatory. So why must we then commit for the second time? But I'll come to the dangers of not committing to the second one. The other cause of complexity is the issue of, which I alluded to, the international trade competition, which has emerged between the developed and developing countries. It may be necessary for Parliament to call for the separation of the WTO issues and the climate change debate. I think they need to be separated. Otherwise, they are polarizing the debate. Again, you'll find that issues of the Doha round are surfacing in the climate change debate, technology, and the transfer of the intellectual property. They are now dominating the climate change debate. South Africa's position. South Africa is calling for an international legal instrument. It doesn't matter what it is, whether it's Kyoto or what, but it must be a legal instrument and it must be international. Because we believe that it will protect weaker countries. I've already alluded to that. Now, I don't know if this has changed, but this is my understanding of what our national mandate is for our national interest. Our national mandate, which is supposed to protect our national interest. I've already said that all countries are doing something, but as a country, we are doing a lot on climate change. In the context of environmental management, we have a huge of legislation and policy across the sector. This would include energy mix policy, which has been there since 2006, I think. It has been there for quite some time. The energy mix policy, which tells us to look at biomass, let me say, all of these things that would constitute a green energy policy. The IRP, which is the new policy for energy, the MPRDA, which is the Mineral and Petroleum Resources Development Act. That act has a component of environment in it, which constitutes one of the four pillars. No company in this country will get a mining license if they do not have an environmental management plan and told us how they are going to manage the environment. The integrated transport strategy, which has seen us getting the house train, is another. There's a strategy. The house train is back and the rear via bus service is about some of the things that will come from the strategy. Again, they are meant to reduce, I've been on the house train. It's so nice to travel on that thing. And a lot of people are actually saying the experience is good. So it will reduce the number of cars on the road. In the process, it will impact on the carbon emissions. So there's a lot that South Africa is already doing. That's my position and our mandate for COP17. Well, I'm not sure if it has changed or not. I have not heard that it has changed. But I think it's important because this really carries national interest. South Africa says the kind of outcome that we're looking for is an outcome that carries a balance between adaptation and mitigation. So that you don't emphasize on mitigation while you don't do anything about adaptation. Also, a balance between climate change imperatives and development imperatives. I've already said that it must be that instrument has to be legally binding. South Africa also has to look at consolidation of the African agenda. I've already made that point. What are the topical issues that will be looked at in Durban? The Kyoto Protocol. Please, I'm begging Parliament. Save the Kyoto Protocol. You kill the protocol for Kyoto Protocol, the climate change agenda is gone. We need to save Kyoto Protocol. It's very important. There's a lot of halu-balu about it. I know it has to come with the long-term, the LCA, all of the two must get together. But if you kill the Kyoto Protocol, you won't be able to make anybody accountable in the climate change management. So this is one of the topical issues that will be, because its life ends in 2012, next year. When it dies, I think all of us, we will start from scratch. Adaptation. As developing countries, we need to watch this with a hawk's eye. I think the comparison that Lulu made is telling. The first meeting that I attended of the Major Economic Forum in France, adaptation was not on the agenda. It was going to be dealt with in the evening. And I asked the question, why? And I was told that no, we'll give it much attention there. Because I thought it should not be kept on the periphery. And when we got there, there was a guy from Grenada, one of the small island developing states, who actually said their economy was, I mean, they were attacked by a hurricane, and the economy came to a standstill for 2 months. Bridges were destroyed, you know, businesses, everything came to a standstill for 2 months. While Katrina, on the other hand, it just took a few weeks and they were back to business. And after this guy made this presentation, nothing happened. There was no discussion. So if we don't watch this adaptation with a hawk's eye, we will lose out as developing countries. Because this is about funds being directed to strengthen the disaster management capacity of countries, of developing countries especially the most vulnerable. And with us, this part of Africa, the 34 least developing countries would benefit from that. It goes together with the establishment of the Adaptation Committee and the Green Fund and so on. The technology thing, I won't talk much about that, but I want to talk about the voluntary payment system. What is happening now, the developed countries, it's clearly written out that they must fork out finances to assist the developing countries. Whether it gets into a fund or anything, but it's supposed to be their responsibility. I think that has not worked. And what is happening now, countries are making pledges as they wish. They will pledge 2 rands, the others 20 rands, the others 5. It's not sustainable. It's not sustainable. You need a fund that is going to ensure that the funding of the climate change program is sustainable. So for me, it's a big issue that you should also be looking at. The role of Parliament, just a few points about debate. I think Mandy alluded to this. Although I've made reference to the COP17, my issue is that maybe you must have a debate 3 times a year led by the portfolio committee. Parliament must have a debate on climate. Why must you be prepared just 2 months before? It doesn't make sense. Because you are bombarded with all of this information all at once. You don't know what, you know, the progression of the debate. You are not privy to that. You don't know the dynamics. You can't ask questions. You just have to bubble up everything and go to a conference and get confused. So, because people are making reference to what they've been talking about throughout the year, why must you be prepared at the end of the year? I think Parliament must have more debates on climate change. There must be a dynamic link between Parliament and the country's negotiating team, because those are the people who have the detail of what is happening in there. Parliament must be presented, must be formally represented as corpses, as all the corpses and all structures created within and during the conference. For instance, there's something called Friends of the Church. It's important that you have a representative there. Whether you will have a representative from the ITU, you know, structure, parliamentarian, I think it's important though that you be represented there in that Friends of the Church. It's kind of a dead looking mechanism that they create for conference, but you know, the transparency of knowing where the debate is going, it becomes very important, and you can only be privy to what is the problem, what is deadlocked, and how is it going to be solved when you are part of that. The implementation of the monitoring of the implementation of policies is what you do. Integration of climate change into broader debates, as was said, already said that. I think it's important, the point that the lady over there raised about the capacity to manage disasters. I think we need to ask questions as members of parliament. Is the country, if we were to experience a tsunami like Indonesia, would we be able to manage it? Japan, recently, do we have capacity to manage that in the country? Having said that, I did not make proposals. I just raised concerns and questions because I don't want to impose on you. I think I came here to advocate rather than impose. I think I am of the view that South Africa is doing a lot and may even be way ahead of many countries. This is my own view. And sometimes we act more like a developed country, especially if we consider the sum total of what we will be achieved through all the programs that we have embarked on. This is my view. The question that I think we need to respond to regarding our participation in this debate, do we want to be a leader in the world in combating climate change? Or do we want to lead the developing world? It's very important, you know. I was listening because, you know, you keep on hearing a lot of calls for South Africa to do this and South Africa to do that, as if there isn't anything that South Africa is doing. And maybe I'm too much of a patriot. And again, I'm not saying South Africa must be complacent, but I think sometimes we are overburdened because we kind of want to be a good example. It's good, but to what extent, at what price, at what cost? I was listening to some input last time where there was a call to put a levy on our exports. That really shook me. It's so much, I got so scared. Because it's an addition of, I'm not saying it should not get there at some point, but the timing, do we have to take all of these things now? And again, if you look at the fact that you are an export-led country, we export gold, we export, this is the backbone of our economy. We export. Now, you put a levy on export, that worries me. What does it do on the cost of the export? And these are questions that parliamentarians must interrogate. What does it do on the cost of the export? What does it do on the operational cost of the companies that export? What does it, how will it impact on the jobs that we need in this country? So for me, that's why I'm asking, do we want to be a leader in the world in combating climate change, or do we want to be a leader? What is it that we want? Because we need to answer those questions. What is it that we're looking for? What is our role in this? You know, because it can't be just contribution that is not defined. We need to define our role and our participation. The second question that I'm raising, what do we see as our priority? Is it poverty alleviation? or is it combating climate change? Again, I already answered that question, that it can't be either or. I think the, you know, it should be a hybrid between the two. And for me, that's I've already answered that question. The third question, to what extent are we pushing the national interest, and how do we assess that? Should this not be an area for the oversight role of Parliament? I think the national interest issue must be responded to. Are we pushing it? What is our national interest? They are difficult questions, but I think they are at the core of this national debate. But I don't feel that there's a national debate on climate change. I'm sorry, I'm not criticizing anybody here, but I'm saying I don't feel there's a national, and there is a danger if there's no national response. As we speak, there's what is called, I don't know what it stands for, the EPA in the US. The United States of America society is actually kicking this debate, climate change debate, out. They don't want it. Why? Because they were left behind. I think whoever has raised the point that we need to take our people on board, raised a very, very important point. This is not about intellectual. It's not an intellectual debate. This is a serious social problem. And it needs society. It needs my mother to know that when I plant this tree in my yard, this is what, if I plant it as a runner, it will, as a runner is a gusher of water. It will take up a lot of water if I plant it in my yard. But if I plant another indigenous tree, then that's the one that will help me. She must understand that. Simplify, demystify. When I got in, I said, demystify, and people did not understand. They thought I was crazy. And this is what I meant. Demystify this thing. Bring it to the level of the people. Because unknowingly, people do things that will create more emissions. Because they don't know. So education, I think a number of people raised that issue of education. But it goes together with national interest. What is the socio-economic impact of climate change on our country? Either from a positive perspective or a negative perspective. We introduced the green economy. What is the green economy, or let's say the phrase, how is the green economy going to benefit us as South Africa? Have we prepared our people to participate in the green economy? So I'm saying all of those are questions that as representatives of the people should really be beginning to interrogate. Are we driving the climate change debate internally? Or are we reacting to external pressure? More often than not, I feel that we are responding to external pressure. When we are told to reduce and to drop coal, you know, there's a lot of noise in the newspapers that South African government does not want to stop using coal. But I think there needs to be a debate that yes, we have to do something about our coal dependence. But how do we do it? We can't just drop. How do we do it? Those are the questions that we internally as a country need to be looking at. Because I really feel sometimes that we are reacting from external pressure. But then what capacity do we need to respond? And where are we lacking in that capacity? Do we need technology? Do we need human? Because in university, at university, this climate change thing has not even taken off. Who's going to interpret this for our children in this society and our grandmothers who are not educated? Universities themselves, to the extent that I would expect, I don't know now, maybe they've warmed up to it and they've introduced the subject at school. But a very few few environmental scientists in South Africa. Very, very few. What is happening in the curriculum, as many of you raised, the school? Why are you not ensuring that our children are being educated? Because climate change is going to be with us forevermore. Amen. Thank you very much. I'm done. But how do we ensure participation by all stakeholders, civil society, WWF? Why don't they, you know, run this workshop? Because you can't get all of this information one day and you all you understand it all. You have to, just 1 minute there, I'm sorry to take so long. The continent, how do we relate to it? My last point is I think it is important. What your dad says is very important. Empower members to empower the nation. Otherwise, if members are not empowered, very little will happen in our communities. I'm sorry to take so long. Thank you.
Thank you, Mama. Welcome, House Chair Hajan. And also other members from Kofi Mandela, so Utata, Ustalin, so also Utata Kinol, and many other members who have just arrived. We have begun today a process where we getting members workshopped on climate change. Tomorrow the session continues, and also on Friday. A number of points have been raised, and unfortunately we are now literally running out of time. But what I propose we do, there is tea outside. We don't break the tea. Quietly out, quietly in, and quietly drinking, and quietly snacking. As we continue. So that's number one. Number two, I'll suppose that we don't engage with questions now. We allow Kekana from the Environment Department. The issues are related. So that whatever issues that could be raised, Mr. Kekana is able to get us going on those. So that's what I would really propose you do. And then, concluding the presentation of the film, and Kelana, who then take us through on our role and also some of the programs that we have for ourselves, within which to then take our discussion forward from there. Okay, thank you very much once again, Mama. Then we will continue what you are suggesting where you are, taking the full presentation together.
Thank you, Chair, and good afternoon to honorable members. My presentation is going to be very short and brief because Mama Sonji has already covered a lot of issues that I was going to raise. I'll just give a short background and then go straight into the overview of the negotiations and just to explain where we are, where we are going. But just to give a short background on the structure that Mama Sonji has already alluded to. The negotiations are taking place under the United Nations Human Convention on Climate Change. And this convention meets once a year at the Conference of Paris. So this year is the 17th Conference of Paris, and it's coming to Durban, South Africa. There are about 192 signatories to the convention, but the convention itself gets back to the Kyoto Protocol that the two speakers have talked about. In 2005, it came into effect. It classifies, the protocol classifies countries as Annex 1 countries and non-Annex 1 countries, that is developing and non-developing countries. And there was the first commitment period where Annex 1 parties agreed to take legally binding commitment. Jointly, they agreed to doing 5.2% reduction of greenhouse emissions below 1990 level for that period of 5 years. So that period is coming to an end next year. But when the protocol came into effect, we also launched an ad working group to negotiate the second and subsequent commitment period. So the negotiation under the Kyoto Protocol is for the second and subsequent commitment period. The first one, as I've already said, is coming to an end next year. But then the challenge was that the U.S. never ratified the protocol. It negotiated the protocol, but it never ratified it. So what parties to the convention did in 2007 in Bali was to come up with the Bali Action Plan. That is a mandate to negotiate under a new threat for the USA. We normally call it the USA threat. It's an adverse working group for long-term cooperative action. So the negotiations in Durban will be structured as such. There will be four bodies meeting. First, you will have your conference of parties agenda, and then you've got a meeting of the parties under the Kyoto Protocol agenda, and you'll have an agenda for the AWGKP, a working group for the KP, and you'll have an agenda for the LCA, the long-term cooperative action under the convention. But also added to that, there are two permanent subsidiary bodies to the convention. One is called SBR, Subsidiary Body on Implementation. It will have its own agenda, and then you'll have the one, another subsidiary body that deals with science and technology with its own agenda. So you can see you in Devon, you'll have about 15, 16 meetings every hour. And this is where you see the dominance of China and the U.S., which comes with roughly around 300 delegates, more than half of those being the lawyers and the cooks. And you've got your Namibia, your Malawi coming with two delegates. So that is how skilled these negotiations are. And of course, Minister Ngwana Mashabane will preside over the conference. But my minister, Mr. Mulewa, will lead the South African delegation because we still have to protect our national interests in this negotiation. So as a department, we will be leading that. But that does not mean we don't work together. We provide technical support to the incoming co-president, which is Minister Ngwana Mashaba. So South Africa, under these negotiations, is committed to engaging in the negotiations with a view of requiring a binding multilateral international agreement. And this is where the problem is at the moment. We can see that the multilateralism itself is under serious attack and is manifested in various forms. One of the forms being that the legally binding framework, the Kyoto Protocol, must start. And we go into what we call the Wild West, so everybody can do what they like at their own pace. So that's the first point. But we also engage in the engaging the talks such that we can have an international regime which should be balanced and prioritized between adaptation and mitigation. For Africa, adaptation is quite key because there are greenhouse gases that are already committed in the atmosphere. So no matter what happens, you still need to adapt. And you'll hear people talking about adaptation as key for Africa. But the problem here is that the cost of adaptation is tied to the amount of mitigation that you do. So if you do less mitigation, it means it will cost you more to adapt. And already we don't have capacity and the resources to adapt. And it's quite important then to focus on mitigation. So the central discussion in Durban will be around mitigation. And what seems to be emerging as we're speaking,
there are two schools of thought. The one is about a comprehensive regime with a legally binding agreement which is top-down, or an incremental progress, but a piecemeal approach. We do this, what we can now, and do what we can tomorrow. So those are two schools of thought that are competing. And these two schools of thought manifested themselves at the first meeting in Bangkok. That was held in Bangkok this week. The media and everybody said Bangkok was a failure because it focused on the agenda. People could not agree. They talked about the agenda for 5 days. But it was not really about the agenda. It was about these two schools of thought. Do you go for the comprehensive regime or do you go for the incremental progress? But in the end, of course, we managed to capture both. Just to talk a little bit about the dynamics in the negotiation. Pre-Cancun, or the last conference, as I said, was in Cancun, which was COP16, and COP17 is coming there. The negotiations just focused on building a transparent and comparable framework for the U.S. under the convention. As I've already said, the U.S. did not ratify this Kyoto Protocol. And the U.S. gave reasons that it will not do so until China is equally bound. But China, on the other hand, reiterated that it is a developing country, and under the convention, it clearly stated that developing countries cannot take legally binding commitments, but they can do actions which are supported, of course. So there is this standoff, as already been alluded, between the U.S. and China. The U.S. says it cannot do this until China do that, and China says no, it cannot do this because it's a developing country. But in honest fact, I mean, I think the U.S. is just playing the media around this one. What is very clear is that the U.S. will never sign to any multilateral agreement until they've got a corresponding domestic policy at home. And from where we are sitting, the U.S. does not have that. We all know that Obama tried to push that in the Senate and it was rejected. So this thing that if China do this, I will do this, is just a way of U.S. Trying to get around the issue. And in our own analysis, we think maybe around 2014 or so, the U.S. will be ready. There's too much pressure in the U.S. for Obama to reintroduce the bill in the U.S. So until we can all rest assured that until the U.S. has a corresponding domestic policy, it will never ratify any international agreement. So that is the problem that we are faced with. But there are positive signs. It's not all doom and gloom. We've seen countries like blocs like the EU coming forward to say that they want to go into the second commitment period. But in return, they want something from the developing countries, and specifically the basic group that the minister has alluded to. So they want us to give a signal as basic, which includes South Africa, that at some point in time, we will be ready to take legally binding commitment. Because at the current moment, we don't have any legally binding commitment. Yes, of course, we all do action, which should be supported and are recognized as such. But they want a signal from us that at some point we will be ready to manage the project. So if that comes through for them, they are ready and willing in Durban to commit into a second commitment period. So from last year in Cancun, let me start with Copenhagen, where I was with Mama Solji. The negotiations in the previous year in Copenhagen were regarded as a failure because the Bali Action Plan that we are talking about, the two-year program that we are talking about, was meant to conclude in Copenhagen. But that did not happen, as we all know, because of the way the conference was organized. And the way the Danish President did the whole conference, So it was regarded as a failure. It was only rescued by President Zuma and a few other presidents who came up with the Copenhagen Accord, which captured a lot of places from various countries. And that Copenhagen Accord is what was actually transformed into the formal negotiations in Cancun. So we saw the Cancun Agreement actually being a replica of the Copenhagen Accord. And the Cancun Agreement, we can categorize them into three areas. The first one, which was a major success for Cancun, was around the institution. So it did launch things like the Green Climate Fund, the technology mechanism, and the adaptation framework. So that was the first one around institutions. Then there was a decision also to set a process to elaborate the governance operational procedures for those institutions in their area. So the work that has been done throughout the year, this year around that area, must be concluded in Durban. And then the third area of the Cancun Agreement is around those areas where there was no agreement, for example, difficult areas such as the intellectual property rights, the legal form, second commitment period, there was no agreement. But all those issues were transferred to Durban. And they must be dealt with in Durban. In terms of the operationalization of Cancun, it started very well with the Green Climate Fund, its transitional committee, which is designing this. We got instructions to nominate Minister Trevor Manuel to co-chair the design of Green Climate Fund, just to protect the interests of the developing countries. We initially, as the department, or as the focal point, the department, our department is the focal point for climate change. So we initially nominated a competent person, but then there was an understanding from the high office that we need even more somebody with the caliber of Trevor Manuel. So we nominated him. And we went to the first meeting in Mexico this year, where he was elected, together with other three co-chairs. And they are currently meeting, this is the third meeting of the Transitional Committee, they are currently meeting in Geneva as we speak for the design of this Green Climate Change Fund. Also, there was a slow takeoff when it comes to the technology mechanism. It only met 2 weeks ago in Bonn. But nonetheless, it met. And then the first meeting, as I've already said, the first formal meeting took place in Bangkok, where we set the agenda and the mandate for negotiation for this year. The meeting reached a compromise around the Bali Action Plan and the Cancun Agreement. But the second meeting that took place in June, that is where we saw substantial progress. Because there were no debates around the agenda. We could move straight into substantive discussion. And we saw some slow progress, but progress nonetheless, whereas we, on technical issues, and not on political issues, more technical issues like legal form, second commitment field, but on other technical issues which need to be addressed nonetheless, whichever way the negotiations go, there was quite a good progress around that. But in terms of the preparation within the continent, we are a bloc. We negotiate as a bloc, although not as the EU, because the EU, there's a flag that says the EU, and there's one person who speaks under that flag, but Africa is not like the EU. So every country got its sovereign rights to negotiate and to engage. But nonetheless, there is a bloc, an Africa group of negotiators, where we strategize and form common position. And this common position, as we are speaking, the ministers are discussing it in Bamako, in Mali, as we are speaking now. We hosted the Africa group of negotiators as the department. We had three meetings this year already in South Africa, just to formalize the Africa group, the common position.
And unfortunately, the AU summit came before the AMSEC, the minister segment, which is currently sitting as we speak. So the position went to AMSEC even before it went to AU, even before it went to AMSEC. But there was a decision at the AU that the special head of state committee, which is called CAHO, which is chaired by Ethiopia, should relook at the document once it comes from AMSEC. So we hosted three meetings here in South Africa. We formulated the position, and the position is being discussed by the ministers as we speak now. The Democratic Republic of Congo, of course, is the leader when it comes to African Group of Negotiation. South Africa support. We used to lead various committees within the group, but as the incoming co-presidency, we had to step aside and give it to other countries to help the Democratic Republic of Congo. But as you all know, we found ourselves back in the hospital to help, and we hosted the meetings. But generally, the common position is out now as we speak. But further than that, as a department, you know, the overall logistics are being handled by international relations. Right? And my understanding there is that everything is going smoothly. I mean, the venue, all those things. But as a department, we also thought it would be quite prudent for us to have an expo where civil society, NGOs, and business can come and showcase the activities that are currently happening in the country. And the expo is limited, exclusively limited, to activities that are happening in the country. It might be by international companies or local companies, but the activity must be happening in the country. So as a department, we are also organizing the expo for people to showcase. So far, we have received more than 200 applications of people who want to showcase. We still have to go through the selection and see who can do what well. But on top of that, because I've heard during the first presentation that people want this to be taken to the people, the department is currently rolling out provincial summits, but these provincial summits are more of awareness raising, which is what the House was calling for. We had one in the Eastern Cape already, and 2 weeks ago there was one in Rustenburg and Northwest, and there are other seven which are still planned. And of course, we've got radio messages and TV and all that. So these roadshows are simply aimed at raising awareness. We are taking advantage of COP17 because it's everywhere, it's being talked about everywhere. So we thought we should teach people in simple language. The presentations are there, we can share with you if you want, which simplifies the whole issue of climate change. What is climate change? How does it affect me? What can I do? All those are captured in a very, very simple presentation which is given to the public, ordinary public. So that is the fifth thing that the department is doing. But then what is the national position? On this one, I must add that Minister Mulewa has already stated that the national position will come to cabinet around October for finalization. So it is a process. It is currently underway. We've got what we call Intergovernmental Committee on Climate Change, which includes all government sector departments. But beyond that, you've got the National Committee on Climate Change, which involves the civil society, business, your labor, everybody is represented in that committee. Once the position has gone through those channels, it then goes to the clusters and has a parliament through that until it reaches cabinet. So that is why that is progressing well. But the current position, which is unlikely to change, is that South Africa is calling for a two-track legally binding outcome, one under the convention, where you will have legally binding targets for Annex 1 parties, that is the US and the ship jumpers,
because currently we are faced with parties that were previously in the first commitment period under the Kyoto Protocol that want to go into the convention. If the US is not bound, so can we. Such parties are Russia, as before, Japan, and Canada. So those, we call them the sheet jumpers. So we are calling for a legally binding agreement for them under the convention. And of course, a legally binding support by developed countries for developing countries to undertake their action. Because as Sanjika has said, the convention is very clear that support has to be provided to us in order for us to take our, to do our appropriate action or the actions that we invest in. We presented three projects that we wanted to do, which in total can help us to reduce greenhouse gas emissions to around 15% or so. And the cost of those, the cheapest one was costing 2.7 billion, and the one that can reduce 8.8 billion in the housing sector cost, of course, 11 billion. So you can see there's a lot of money that is required for us to undertake our action. But hopefully the new Green Climate Fund will help us to implement those actions and actually reach the target that we put for ourselves, the 34% that we talked about before Copenhagen. So under the Kyoto Protocol, the developed countries or Annex 1 parties, they deposit their instruments under the Annex B, the quantified emission reductions that they want to do. For example, the EU would say, I want to do 30%. So that goes into Annex B of the Kyoto Protocol and so forth. So the negotiations are about amending that Annex B. You'll hear a lot in Durban about amendments to Annex B, which will affect the second commitment period. So it's around us. And our position is very clear that whatever is being put under that Annex B, it must be consistent with science. The IPCC has already told us that we need to keep temperature increases to below 2 degrees centigrade by 2050. And it gave us the midterm target of 25 to 40%. So if you are going to reach, if you are going to limit your temperature increases to below 2 degrees by 2020, you should be reducing by this much. So our position is consistent with that, so that is what we are calling for. But at the same time, our position is very clear that we need time and space for developing countries to transition to low-carbon economies, because it's unavoidable. We have to transition into low-carbon, so we need time and space. And this is what China really is calling for. It's not necessarily refusing to be bound to anything. It says, what I need is time and space. Of course, at its current economic development, China is able to lift out 1 million people out of poverty every month. But China, at the same time, is doing a lot. If you look at the national five-year plan of China, it's far much more ambitious than what many other developed countries want to do. So what it's calling for is that it shouldn't be legally bound. You cannot go into a commitment when you know you cannot fulfill that. But what it's saying is that this is what I will do. And as a fact, Mama Tony, China has already agreed to MRC process. Okay. It's already there in the Copenhagen Accord. For us as developing countries, we call it international consultation analysis. For them, it's international assessment review. So we are currently in the negotiation trying to elaborate the two. So China has moved slightly to open up on that regard.
So that is our national position in brief, but the 50 pages or so will come before cabinet soon. But you know, there are so many issues in the negotiation. So you need to prioritize and say which 2-3 key issues are you going to tackle. If I get 1, 2, 3, then I know it's a success for me. So we've got national priorities, which in fact was already embedded in the Africa Common Position. These priorities, they were when President Zuma attended the AU summit, they were pronounced as priorities for Africa. The first one is maintaining the integrity of the multilateral process. We are very clear on that one, that it should be priority. And tied to that is an agreement to second commitment period under the Kyoto Protocol and the comparable regime under the convention of a non-Kyoto party. The third priority is, of course, the operationalization of the Cancun institution. There is uniformity. All nations of the world agree that we need to operationalize Cancun institutions. Your Green Climate Fund, there must be a decision on that. So the work that Minister Manuel is doing in the Transitional Committee must result in a very clearly defined decision that can be adopted by the core in Durban. And the fourth one, which Africa has said is central to the deal that must be reached in Durban, is the issue of adaptation. Adaptation currently is fragmented. You find a piece there that deals with loss and damage under the FBI. You find a piece that deals with the community there. So we want to consolidate and come out with an agreement, an adaptation decision, which will focus on the implementation. We don't want to theorize. We want a decision that will help us to implement adaptation action that we want to take. So Africa has placed that at the center of any deal in the world. And of course, the last one is focusing on finance, and particularly the design of the Green Climate Fund. So those are the five priority areas that Africa has identified for Durban. If we can achieve those, that will be progress. But the most difficult one, which we've already said, is the third one on my slide, which is the second commitment period under the Kyoto Protocol. Because that one is tied directly to the discussions under the convention or the U.S. threat. How far can you go under that threat? It's tricky in that sense. But what are the emerging scenarios? Because we've had several meetings this year. The incoming co-presidency has also hosted several meetings this year, both ministerial and negotiators meetings. So there are several scenarios which are being floated around. The first one is what we call the KP architecture scenario, where developed country parties enter into a second commitment period and non-KP countries commit to a future binding agreement under the convention. I don't think that one is realistic. There's no way the U.S. is going to be ready to sign anything that is legally binding by the UN. But that would be the best option if it was to happen. And of course, the second scenario is a provisional application for the second commitment period with a comparable obligation for non-Kyoto Protocol. This is more realistic. In our own analysis, we can see a situation in Durban where we will have a second commitment period which is short of ratification. That is, we can have a second commitment period, depending on how the basic countries play their cards. That is the most scenario which seems to be more realistic from where we are sitting. But the third one, of course, is no agreement. We go into a transitional period, no KP agreement, no LCF women, which is quite a possibility. And an outcome. It is better to have such an outcome than a bad outcome. So it is a scenario which is on the table as we are speaking. But hopefully we will not go there. The only problem, if I may add, of the report is that we've seen some of our traditional partners, such as India, trying to renege now on the issue of the second commitment period. They are saying, as the developing countries, we've been compromising a lot. How far should we compromise for the sake of the second commitment period? It's better for us to let the whole thing go. But it's not really India speaking, it is the agreement that India and the US have. It's more, it's related to much more than this climate change discussion. And this issue was first raised in Berlin, the first ministerial meeting which the incoming co-presidency raised, held this year in Berlin, in collaboration with the Germans, where Minister Ramesh put this on the table to say, let's go a voluntary approach. I do what I can do. You do what you can do, and we have an international mechanism to verify that. So we just focus on the ICA and the IAR, that verification system. So let's forget about that. And immediately the US prospered and jumped onto that, agreed with India. China was cautious. I think it was caught off guard. But South Africa and Brazil were shocked by that twist. But it later emerged that there's actually an agreement between India and the US. And we tried to close further on that and we got other confirmation. And I think Minister Johnson is aware that there are efforts now, concerted efforts by South Africa to talk to India so that we go into Durban as a united force. This emerged again in the basic meeting that we recently had in Brazil. The Indians have not yet moved. So those are the complications behind the scenes around the negotiations. We are meeting them again in the major economy forum 2 days or so to chart a way forward around that. So those are the main challenges that we are facing and the new complications that we are facing. As a country which is going to hold the COP. Yeah, I think I will pause there.
Thank you, Members, we should thank you. We should with speed then get going on tempted for us to get done with all the presentations, but. I think it would work out better that we take a pause here. The first pause. Any questions? General? Thank you.
Thank you. Like, we also thank the two presenters for a wonderful brief on the COP17 workshop that we are having. But if you can just also brief us as to what is being done to capacitate people, especially in rural areas. I haven't heard much on that. Through institutions such as the National House of Traditional Leaders, Provincial House of Traditional Leaders, and Controverso. We have a majority of our people located in rural areas and who are really feeling the brunt of climate change. In the winter we've had, in my own lifetime, I saw snow for the first time in villages like in Novo. And the municipality such as that, located in a rural space, with traditional leaders in that area, and no knowledge whatsoever as to what to do. And as far as managing disaster management, there were no resources to enable them to be able to combat such a challenge. So I'd like to know what is being done to really capacitate people in rural areas and traditional leaders to ensure that they come up to readiness in understanding what the COP17 is about. But also, Chair, I also like to understand the role of women in rural areas. Women are often head of households in rural areas, as often men migrate to cities and seek for jobs here. What is being done to capacitate women in rural communities and ensuring that they are up with what is happening as far as COP17 and climate change, and how do people in rural areas and ordinary citizens access information on climate change in order to capacitate themselves? Last question, Chair, is under the global economic crisis and the natural disasters that have been experienced by Japan, what guarantees are in place that the Kyoto Protocol is going to be adhered to and also gain participation of developed nations such as the US and Japan for the second commitment period? Thank you, Chair.
Chairman?
Chairperson, Mama Soybika asked us what role should this country play. Must we focus on the continent or lead international? I think we need to apply a two-pronged strategy approach. You will recall that Copenhagen was more or less failed by this country. A President Zuma's intervention at the last hour. I think we need to continue to position the country on that. Whilst we fight for the developing countries, including our national interests. But the best way of doing that, perhaps, would be for President Zuma to seek a one-on-one meeting with President Obama, leader of China, and all these countries which are sort of trying to backtrack, emphasize the need for them to participate in this. We know the history of the USA, especially on this international convention. I remember when I was still in the department, where they were flatly refused to ratify biodiversity convention. And anything which has got intellectual property rights, which would impact in their intellectual property rights, USA will go slow. But I think it would be good for them, for this conference, that at least, even if they don't sign anything, but they must be seen to be on board. Thank you.
So I hand Baba.
Thank you, Chairperson. Very stimulating presentation on the negotiations around climate change, and perhaps one of the big issues for us as grassroots workers is what we conceive of as a legacy for COP17. Maybe this has not, it may have come up. But what I'm asking is, how much attention do we give so that we weigh the sort of work we do on what the country itself will produce around issues that relate to climate change, as much as we pay attention to the negotiations and ensuring that our best interests are represented in those negotiations. So the strategy around a legacy program and the amount of attention placed there can disappear below the surface in our anxiousness to win friends to the lowest common denominator. So this is the concern that I have. The second one, Met Sonic, says Bolivia was not interested in climate change. Bolivia presented positions which were disagreed. There are ideological struggles around climate change negotiations. And so it is those issues that we would like to know. What is South Africa's position to the issues that were raised by Bolivia, supported by Venezuela? And what is the reason for our disagreement with those issues? Because I don't think they're not interested in climate change per se, but there's a debate and a disagreement. So I think it would be appropriate for us to represent others with dignity, even if we disagree with them. But in this instance, for example, I really would like to hear from both of them their recollection of the arguments that were raised by Bolivia and Venezuela. Thank
you. Followed by Bawanjika. Last one.
Yeah, maybe it's enough to start the South Africa to have a green economic policy. I'm saying this because there is a lot of money which is put aside by the IPC for the green economy, and they are saying that we need to start this environment. To say as South Africa can't we come up with a green economic policy, maybe it will assist us also to be able to find our success.
Last one, Mr. Silana.
Thank you, Chair. For me, the transition that has emerged in multilateral negotiations, particularly as practiced by the government, was to ensure that when government engages in the negotiation, it takes the country, that is the various sectors, on board and into confidence. And a good example is Doha Round. The Department of Trade and Industry is the lead of a department that handles the Doha Round. We'll only start with a stakeholder consultation session right inside South Africa, let alone at the Doha Round itself, and even thereafter. But I haven't picked that up in the climate change. Because generally, you know, my other colleague I had started getting excited as well about that tradition. But I'm sure the department may share with us whether they're not alert and sensitive to that. Let's talk about awareness and need. Because what coming from is, and if one put us in charge of the earlier minister, Comrade Mpatswa, they have done this, I know, because of the part of it. They would call the various stakeholders, engage with them, and have a sense of the level of support and lack of support on specific things as they move into this program. I'm deliberately provocative. Apologies.
The last one, very, very last one is.
Supporters of the schedule for me. Really interest in the area that the department is very weak in. How to make this climate change process. See, because we can play at that international. And then you're very good in pronouncing what the South Africa is doing at that international level. But South Africa, I'm not talking about sophisticated, complicated South Africa. I'm talking about ordinary citizens of our country. Because this is an opportunity to introduce South Africans to a practical side of climate change. And I heard you talking about three projects. But for me, three projects headed by the department could merely be a, what you call a seed fund, or shall I say, an appetizer before the actual meeting. Why can't the department launch a South African campaign for all citizens? There is no significant recycling process in our country. Nothing. There is no significant greening. It's a one-off event in September. There is no significant, even legal, instruction to all of us not to do this. For instance, there are countries where you get arrested for littering. There is nothing in South Africa which is structured for all citizens, local government, provincial government, national government, NGOs, everybody bound by that. And South Africans do not behave as if, okay, let alone hosting COP17, we do not behave as if there is this problem that could create disaster and other things in relation to behavior here. I will go back to the question I raised when the WWF presenter was talking here, that soil erosion is a huge problem in South Africa, and it's based on the fact that majority of citizens in South Africa were cramped into barley farms, overcrowded, overgrazing, over cultivation, and there's no soil, there's no topsoil to speak about to produce food. So I know agriculture is not your responsibility, but I know that it is your responsibility to take care of the environment, to repair the ecosystem. It is your responsibility to legislate. What kinds of trees can be should not be cut? What is this thing called? Harvested. You know, in Botswana, rural people in Botswana, they know what tree you cannot chop down. Everybody knows that. And the chiefs are custodians of those things. In South Africa, everything goes, everything can do, can happen in South Africa. There's no law that says you cannot do this, you cannot do that. In environmental terms, yes, there are small initiatives taken by one municipality there. For instance, the lady from DA was saying in Cape Town, this is what they are doing to initiate recycling. I'm talking about a South African effort for all of us to pursue around that program. Why?
Sorry, Chairperson, with your permission. I just thought that it's important for us to acknowledge that we've had a public hearings on climate change hosted by the Portfolio Committee on Environment and Water Affairs and Environment. That's a very important process because, as CISA here is pointing out, the trade union movement made submissions there, business made submissions there, and so on. But I agree with the Honorable CISA when he says, now and then you see 50-50 on television and so on. But you see, there is no feeling of a campaign, right? That is really every turn around you. There are elements of it there and so on, and the green leaf there and so on, but it's not systematic, it's not intense. So we are not going to be able to benefit potentially as we would if we drove this as a campaign across the board. But most importantly, there are things that we can do and enforce. We would like to see a lot more of it or hear where that is. The negotiations are crucial. We must represent our interests to the best that our negotiators can do. There's no doubt about us participating. We just come back from a SALGA conference where there was presentation focusing on local government and what ought to be happening there and so on and so on. So, in the presentation that we would like to see at a practical level inside our country, we would like to hear a lot more coherence of a campaign that is really going to change the nature of the country come 2012. Thank you,
ma'am. Well, once again, the issues of the legacy. We have seen the 2010 soccer tournament legacy progress. whether as we are hosting this year climate change summit by the UN, we will have such aid figures. These are some of the issues that have been raised earlier. And then of course also we did allude to an outreach for our ordinary people out there. Point is once again made practically about what municipalities can do. It's not theoretical. It is practical. Here they find themselves, for instance, also in the Nelson Mandela municipality. When there were those disasters, literally people find themselves wanting. And yet you have a budget this much. And the demand being there. Now, which clearly says that we're finding ourselves really, really in trouble when it comes to working in silos. Whether at the local or provincial or national, within departments and within government, Ms. Ntuli also raised a message here about green policy, green economic policy. We have had the workshops and also summits on green economy, and also there's a white paper on climate change as well. This is our workshop. Not only will the presenters be responding, but again ourselves, all of us, we also have an opportunity to respond and have this more of an interactive exercise. First, you have the first right of the accuser.
Thank you very much, Chairperson and the members. I'll just respond to one question as the chief arrived on the what you call Venezuela and those countries, the Alba countries. When I started my input, I said climate change is an aspect of a broader comprehensive environmental agenda. Just one aspect of that. And I said the key principle about that environmental agenda is sustainable development, growth and development. We all appreciate that this originates from the Rio conference. And I want to take it back to talk about where does Rio originate from. Rio originates in Stockholm Conference 1972. And the issue or the basis for this environmental agenda was if people get to the internet, they will get this information. There's a worrying issue there that says the question that they would be interrogating at the Stockholm conference would be, how do we limit economic growth through natural resources or using natural resources? There's that question. I'm raising this because this is Stockholm conference gave birth to the Rio conference. So if the basis was that, from the start there was some problem there. Problems that feed to the skeptics, because the basis on which the environmental agenda was started was not quite vast, according to my own view. Now, if you take that as your background, then you understand where the Alpha countries come from, because they are saying this climate change agenda is an imperialist agenda, which is meant to stifle growth in the developing world. That's what they are saying. And if we commit to an internationally, legally binding agenda, which is in reality meant to target China, because China is the only country
that is moving so fast to threaten the hegemony of the United States. That's the problem. Now, if then we are going to be part of this binding agreement, which is actually targeting China, we are going to be hedging ourselves. It will impact on our own growth and development because we will be bound by what this is what the Alpha countries are saying. And as I'm saying, this is the basis, they come from 1972, the Stockholm Conference, unfortunately, whether rightful or wrongly. This is my own understanding of this. Now, the biggest challenge that we have in this is what I don't want to talk about myself, but is what we have been raising within the major economic forum, which is chaired by the United States. That there is no way that there could be a legally binding regime that will regulate one country and one country only, China. So if we agree to a legally binding that means that is targeted to help China, it will do likewise to us as developing countries. So there is no way. We need to find this balance that will take a little bit of from all of us. You know, all of us must compromise, all of us must benefit. And this is the approach that we have in South Africa. Because you can't single out China and in the process you want to bring that into the negotiation. Now I want to leave this up with what I said, that don't be fooled. This is about national interest. And if anything, countries will protect their national interest. From the US to China to Russia, all countries, there's something in the back pocket that they will never give away. That's why I was saying caution. Let us not give away everything all at once. Because we may be a guinea pig. We may be a guinea pig to deal even with China. Let me talk about it. Because this is the sense that I was getting, where we were being used to get even with China. You get even with China, China is a developing country. And you fall in the same category as China. So you do that, you cut your face, your nose to spite your own face. So I'll leave it at that because it's a bit odd politically. And unfortunately, Letizia, unfortunately, if there's anything that we shy away from, is to debate the politics of climate change. Nobody's debating the politics of climate change. Immediately when you raise the politics, you are told that no boomer because I mean, yes, we will, those disasters will be there. They are managed, they happen every day. But let's also deal with the politics of climate change. This issue of responsibility. Who is responsible? Who must take the lead? I mean, even as we speak, the US is still the number one emitter. Even as we speak. Still, why is it emitting that much when it is a developed country, when it is the power of the world? It's a superpower. Why? Why is it using 51% of coal from coal in generating their electricity? Why is it reluctant to use clean coal technology? It's because it is defending or protecting its national interest. So I'll leave it at that because you touch the political light wire, which is and this is what worries me, that the politics of this thing is not debated anyway.
Okay, man.
Of that, I think it would help maybe in future to have workshops separating the issues of national climate change issues and international climate change issues, because a lot of questions which are raised here are more related to national process, and there is a process, as it has already been alluded to, we in the department, you are in the process of analyzing the white paper, which addresses a lot of issues which were raised here. So I think, as a comment, it would be important sometimes to have two separate workshops, one dealing with national climate change issues and one dealing with international negotiations. Because we have set of different people here to address that. But I think I also have good comments. For example, the issue of reaching rural people through Contra Delta and other traditional houses. I think that's a very, very good legitimate comment. So far, what we've been focusing on in terms of mass mobilization was not really targeted to rural people except through local radio community stations. But I think we can integrate some of the comments that we have here. And in terms of the workshops, we do have workshops when we draft the position. We have national consultation workshops. Normally, if I can vouch for that, we hosted two the previous year. In addition to normal processes that we go through, the committees that I talked about. And we will be holding some again this year. So that is a normal practice. It is also happening in the climate change as well. But there was a difficult issue about a guarantee that Japan and the US will take the second commitment period. Japan has clearly indicated it will not go into the second commitment period. It has restated that over and over again. But as a negotiator, I can tell you now that Japan will actually take it will take the second commitment period. If there is a political a second commitment period, it will take. But in terms of the US was never even part of the first commitment period, so there's no question that it will go into the second commitment period. It will not do that. Hence, we've got another track which tried to negotiate something for the US, the FDA that we talked about. But Japan is a risk. It said it would jump ship, so is Russia, so is Canada. But depending on how we play the game, there might still be the second. But nonetheless, even if they are not in the second commitment period, we still need a second commitment period because we cannot afford to lose the Kyoto Protocol. It is a very sophisticated set of accounting rules, and it's enforceable. It's got a comparability system. You've got committees that deal with those issues. So we cannot, from all we're sitting, afford to lose the Kyoto Protocol. Hence, we're pushing very hard for Devon to pronounce on the second commitment period. And the issue of the legacy project for COP17 okay. Is also tied to the work that the incoming COP president is doing. I think they've got a very clear program in terms of legacy, what needs to be done. So that is being catered for by the incoming COP president. But beyond that, I think what COP17 should do for us is to help us raise awareness, as Copenhagen did. After Copenhagen, there was a lot of talk about climate change, which is what we should aim for COP17, the way beyond COP17, because we cannot limit ourselves to the 4 months that are left now. We should be planning for beyond COP17. How are we going to take these initiatives forward beyond COP17. I think that is an issue that we also need to integrate into our own planning within the department. But the other issue that I had was on Bolivia. As a matter of fact, we agree with Bolivia on many issues. Of course, we disagree with them on some issues, for example, they are calling for limiting temperature increases to 1 degree centigrade. That would just kill your economic development. So we differ on that one. And of course, Bolivia is opposed to using carbon markets. That is another factor. We differ on that one as well. And when it comes to allocating carbon space, we differ in the matter of concept, the way it's defined, if it is something that is physical that you can allocate to parties. So we've got a different concept on that one. But on more fundamental issues, which are real issues, such as the continuation of the Kyoto Protocol, we are in agreement. We speak with one voice. They form part of T77 plus China, which is currently engaging with the EU with the view of saving the Kyoto Protocol. So Bolivia is central to those discussions. So we tend to agree on more fundamental issues. We might disagree on those technical issues like using carbon offset, and the fiscal space, the allocation of carbon budget. That is where we stand with Bolivia. And we've got, luckily, we've got good country to country relations on that with Bolivia. But in terms of the green economy, somebody raised the issue of the green economy. As a department, I mean, it was when Mama Conchita was still the minister, that we did launch a paper on green economy. And it was well attended and well received. But the issue of green economy has since been moved to Minister Patel. And I think he's pursuing it vigorously and putting a lot of resources into it. I think it was a wise decision to move it there because I think now it's receiving much more attention and resources. So I'm well aware that they are doing a lot on that, and the policy will soon emerge out of that. Yeah, the rest, I think there were more comments which were very, very, very good comments. And just as an information sharing, I think the Department of Rural, that deals with rural and women, is also now involved in climate change. They had their first workshop 2 weekends ago, which our minister attended and presented at his party. Unfortunately, I'm not aware of the outcome, but my feeling is that they must have mapped out a way forward on that. And as a department, we've also hosted several meetings or workshops on climate change agenda, or gender in climate change. We've also hosted several meetings around that. But I'm happy now that the relevant department is also now on board. Because when you have the relevant department, then things get much more attention than when it is just one department. I think I'll end it there. There were other good suggestions, like President Zuma visiting other countries. Maybe in that list, we should also include India as well. And also a very good suggestion. Thank you.
Members, we are almost 1 o'clock. A lot has been said, and we are also expected to have Miguel to present. Now we need to make a decision as to whether we continue with that and have another hour. We are continuing tomorrow on a similar program. Mr. Kekana will still be around. I'm not sure, Mama Sandita, whether we'll be around tomorrow. I'm informed that she is going to be around too. And I'm also informed that we'll have, you know, somebody else also from WWF will be coming to present to us. Now, I think a point having been made about, you know, having to locate whatever we do out there, bring your people with you. You are suggesting that we need to separate the two. In my view, you don't have to. To an extent, you need to once again call on that slogan of people living with disability. Nothing about us without us. So so that whatever positions you put out there, they are about us as people in this country, so that we are able legitimately, of course, you know, to suggest that, yes, of course, there are other processes. Mr. Jigalana will be talking to, among others, the seminar planned by Parliament to take place sometime in October. He will give us details about all of those issues and the kind of program that Parliament is engaged in. I want to suggest that we don't go ahead now, Mr. Jigalana. Perhaps we'll start tomorrow. We'll start with your input, with your presentation, so to speak. Locate the role of our Parliament in the whole climate change, you know, discourse in our country, so that we are able to see as to how we then get to Zoom as members of Parliament in the whole debate. So that we are able to say, all being said by Mama Sonji, by a number of other presenters, our role as members of Parliament, having to be located and being contextualized. So that's the kind of briefing and the presentation that we'll be getting from Ubaba Untigelani. I was just wondering, without concluding on a number of very important and exciting positions and points and comments being made by members here, that we don't capture any of those, rather we continue as we are proceeding tomorrow and Friday. And then at the end of the day, Mr. Frolic will be here tomorrow. We then capture all of those in one. Proposal, we adjourn for now. Unfortunately, lunch is only served for the guests. Mr. Nyigana is saying there is no lunch. Until we meet tomorrow at 9 o'clock, same day, same time. Thank you. We are only informed that the session is only tomorrow, which is the last one. Not Friday. So today and tomorrow.
So I must write down the script. NTLLY.
NTU.
Aha, NTU.
LI.
Yeah. And he's from Economic Development. Economic Development, and your
Hey, Monday, what's this?